Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam and Joe, we hope you had a fantastic weekend. Glad that you're with us today. We've got a very busy show. Coming up on the program this hour, our friend S.E. Cupp from the New York Daily News talking about Hillary Clinton's, she says, offensively false claim about Bernie Sanders and gun industry immunity. This as Bernie Sanders seemed to flip-flop on the Sunday shows and said, yes, absolutely, people have the right to sue gun manufacturers. And then he kind of elaborated in, a little bit today saying everybody has the right to sue everybody. But it doesn't mean that you're going to win here. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, continues to talk up her anti-gun policies in the lead-up to the New York primary coming up tomorrow. We'll talk also later this hour with Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner about the New York primary. He's got a piece, New York Exceptionalism and Donald Trump. Michael, the co-author of the Almanac of American Politics, really the dean of American politics. Perhaps the dean of Canadian politics will join us next hour as well, Brian Lilly from the Rebel and the Blaze, on the report that criminals in Canada are getting their guns from Canadians, which is it's actually kind of an interesting story because usually Canada likes to blame the United States for arming its criminals. But apparently the criminals are figuring out how to get their guns in Canada, too. Bob Aldridge from Indiana Firearms Training, with a little bit of a war of words with his local paper. You remember this piece? It came out, I think, in The Lancet a few weeks ago. It's a quote-unquote study that purported, if we just passed three really simple gun laws, why we could reduce violent crime by as much as 90%. The three laws that would need to be passed, apparently, they said universal background checks on the sale of ammunition, and maybe it was a firearms registry or something like that. That was the third one. If you do those things, you can reduce violent crime by 90%. Now, even folks who are not exactly on the pro-gun side of the aisle had issues with the bold claims made by these researchers. Bob also took some issue here, given that these theories were thrown out there without a degree of skepticism there in his local paper. So he had some words with the editor. He'll join us to talk about it. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom coming up in Hour 3. Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates, with the latest out of California. Gavin Newsom, you know, he is running for governor. He is currently the lieutenant governor there in California. I don't believe that he is a Bradley Cooper lookalike as a professional job. Could you look that up, Cameron? What's his hourly rental rate to stand in as Bradley Cooper there? $75 an hour, something like that? He doesn't need the money. Trust me.
It's California. There's got to be there's got to be a minimum wage for celebrity impersonators.
It's got to be more than $15 an hour.
That's
for
sure.
You know, you got to dress the part, right? So he is trying to differentiate himself from what is expected to be a fairly crowded field of candidates. They're running for governor, and the vehicle that he is using is this campaign for a safer future or something like that. It's his gun control referendum that he wants to put on the ballot in California. In order to do this, you've got to collect signatures. And in California, honestly, it's a fairly easy process. That's why we've seen so many referendums in the state over the past few years. So there's video out of one of these signature gatherers, and he's outside. I think it's outside of Walmart. And he's talking to people about the signature. Would you like to sign about this one? This one is about this. And he just flat out lies about what these proposals are. We're going to share this later when we talk with Chuck as well. It's only about a minute long, though. Take a listen and a look at this, because it's unbelievable, the stuff he's just spouting off. Take a look.
This one, if someone wants to buy a large quantity of ammunition, like 1,000 bullets, 500 magazine clips, single magazine clips, you're going to have to go through a background check. Just for large quantity, regular amounts is fine. Just for large quantity.
Okay, so now restate that.
If someone wants to buy a large quantity of ammunition, like 1,000 bullets, you're going to have to go through a background check. Most individuals, to pass a background check, if you want to buy a large quantity. Regular amounts is fine.
What's a regular amount?
I don't know exactly.
What's large?
I know because they're making, people make bombs with like large quantities out of the ammunition. So for large quantities, you'd have to go through a background check. Also, like 500 magazine clips, you have to go through a background check for large quantity of magazine clips. 46. You're a war
baby. Is it? Who's putting this out?
I don't know exactly. I just know they're obviously initiatives they gave us to get on to about it.
Okay. I'm not going to sign that.
Yeah, so I don't even know where we want to start with that here. It doesn't just apply to those large quantities, those, 1,000 bullets or 500 magazine clips or whatever that guy was talking about. The concern, at least stated by Gavin Newsom, is not that people are using the ammunition there to manufacture bombs. No, the idea is that, it's ridiculous that you have to go through a background check to purchase a firearm in California, but you don't have to go through a background check to purchase an ammunition in California. Not a single round. So we got to have this background check so that we can deter criminals from purchasing ammunition, is the idea. Now, practically speaking, in New York, under the SAFE Act passed back in 2013, which 3 years ago now, they had a similar provision. Every time you went and you purchased ammunition, you had to go through a background check. They haven't implemented this 3 years later because they can't figure out how to actually do it without, again, charging somebody $25 using the NICS system every time somebody purchases a box of ammunition. Which, by the way, you think the NICS system is busy now. Wait until it's expected to handle ammunition purchases. So this is another do something proposal here by Gavin Newsom. It's not a serious proposal. Again, there's been a pretty broad coalition of folks opposed to these ideas. Everybody from gun owners, whether they're, gun owning for self-defense or for competitive shooting or for hunting, to police officers. You've got a lot of the county sheriffs. In fact, the State County Sheriffs Association has come out in opposition. Prosecutors have come out in opposition as well, in part because they say this puts the focus where it doesn't need to be. Look, California, nationwide, we've got problems with our law enforcement budgets. A lot of departments are having to do more with less. And this is nothing new. Really, you go back to 2009 when the, 2008 when the housing market crashed and a lot of local and municipal budgets cratered as a result. A lot of these departments haven't come back since then. So they are dealing with a finite amount of resources. And it's really easy for politicians to say, oh, we're going to do more. We're going to give you more. Just elect us and, everything will be great. But it hasn't really happened for a lot of these departments. So these police officers, these prosecutors, they know how difficult it is to actually go out and be tough on criminals right now. Again, 97% of felony cases are plea bargain. The goal seems to be move folks through the system as quickly as possible. They already know how hard it is. In California, it's even harder because the state doesn't have enough prison spaces. They passed a couple of years ago a referendum that allowed for the early release of inmates, put more inmates who should be in the state prison system in the county jails. And the state of California is really dealing with the impact of this right now. So these law enforcement professionals, be they cops or prosecutors, know that if they are told, hey, go after the law-abiding gun owner, right? Make sure that these background checks are being conducted on ammo sales. Make sure that nobody has a magazine over 10 rounds. That's the other proposal. The ban on magazines over 10 rounds for purchasing has been in effect for quite some time, but they want to get rid of those grandfathered magazines in California. And so the people who are actually tasked with protecting and serving the communities that they serve say, no, we need to go in a different way here. This isn't going to make California any safer. Matter of fact, this is going to make California a more dangerous place. So we'll talk about it again with Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates coming up in hour three. Just a reminder, by the way, that down in Georgia, the campus carry bill is still on the desk of Governor Nathan Deal. He has a few weeks until May the 4th to sign the bill or veto the bill. If he does nothing, then the bill does become law. There's also the omnibus gun bill that's on his desk there in Georgia. Now, I remind you of this because the anti-gun activists in the state are trying to keep up a steady amount of pressure on the governor. So you too, if you're a Georgia gun owner, if you're a college student, if you're the parent of a college student down in Georgia, make sure that the governor has been hearing from you. You don't just have to make one phone call or email. You can let the governor know that you're still paying attention to this. At the University of Georgia, there is a group of poets who have united to oppose campus carry. The Poetry Action Network. Magdalena Zarowski, who is a creative writing professor, and Jenny Gropp, managing editor of the Georgia Review, the founders of the Poetry Action Network. They say that they are hoping that other professors and students will join them on April the 20th, Wednesday of this week, for a day of action demanding Governor Deal veto the campus carry bill. They are hoping to Twitter bomb the governor with photos of support all day on Wednesday, April the 20th, support for the vetoing of the bill. The Poetry Action Network says this isn't an issue specific to the state of Georgia. Guns and gun violence are an American problem, and many of us teach and work at universities. We see campus carry as an important political issue for poets, writers, and editors throughout the United States. The gun lobby came for Georgia now, but we have no doubt that they will knock on your university doors soon if these policies are allowed to persist. You know, what's interesting is that I'm trying to figure out how campus carry is anti-poetry. To me, campus carry would seem to be poetry neutral. In fact, I would guess that there's nothing about being a poet that would preclude you from also being a concealed carry holder. Right? But apparently not. Apparently there is only one way to think there on the campus of the University of Georgia. One way for these poets to feel. Imagine that. Academics telling poets, telling artists that there is only one correct way to feel. Creepy stuff. They say in a letter to colleagues, dear poets, writers, editors, and friends, in an effort to fight the campus carry bill, we have decided to create the Poetry Action Network. We want to protect our students, our colleagues, our classrooms and offices, and ourselves from the concealed carry holders that they are interacting, by the way, with on a daily basis around Athens, Georgia, but never mind that. And we hope that you, the poets, writers, and editors who we've come to trust, will join us in protecting public spaces of education, and we welcome anyone who wishes to help to join us, too. So, again, the Poetry Action Network will be hoping to Twitter bomb Governor Nathan Deal on Wednesday of this week. So if you are a gun owner, if you are a concealed carry holder, if you are a campus carry supporter, again, make sure that Governor Deal has heard from you. You don't have to wait until Wednesday, but Wednesday might be a good day to drop a note or a phone call as well. All right, stick around. When we come back, after a quick time out here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, S.E. Cupp, writing at the New York Daily News, will enjoy. Oh, I hope she doesn't get in any trouble with the editors for appearing on NRA News. They don't seem to like the NRA too much, but whatever. They let S.E. appear in the pages. Talking about Hillary Clinton's false claim about Bernie Sanders and the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Stick around. We are just getting started on this Monday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Dennis Willing with the NRA Competitive Shooting Division. Dennis, welcome back to NRA News, and we are talking Bianchi Cup. It's that time of year again. What is the NRA Bianchi Cup?
Bianchi Cup is NRA action shooting. It is not a run-and-gun type sport like you see in some places, perhaps like three-gun. But it is a stationary sport where you compete against the clock. It's a combination of speed and accuracy, not of one's agility.
All right. And it's out in Columbia, Missouri, and it's in May 24th to 28th, correct?
Correct.
All right. And Dennis, we see some of the best shooters from around the country and, quite frankly, from around the world come out to Bianchi. Why is that?
It is just a very exciting sport that people enjoy very much because of it combines the speed and accuracy elements. We have a tremendous number of international shooters come over from Australia, New Zealand, and Germany, and who knows where, Canada. And we have recently generated interest, believe it or not, down in Chile. They're now running Bianchi Cup matches in Chile.
It's amazing to see this all coalesce at a shooting club in Columbia, Missouri every year. It's an amazing thing to see. And this year, brand new, a feature, a new championship round presented by Colt. That sounds like fun.
It is. It's going to make for an exciting finish. We're going to take the top divisions and divide them out and put them on the line. They're going to shoot head-to-head. They're going to shoot their first round, and then they're going to shoot a second round for the top competitors, and they're going to shoot for the cups, the women's cup, the men's cup, the production. It's going to be an exciting finish.
All right, Dennis Willing, thanks for what you do at NRA, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America. And I'm freedom's safest place.
What kind of government cares more about appeasing Islamic terrorists than defending the constitutional rights of its citizens? A government that would disarm us during the age of terror. Nothing would make us more vulnerable to generations of suffering and slaughter than the destruction of our Second Amendment. But many of our politicians, aided by a relentless media, are launching that attack themselves. They dream of joining the rest of the disarmed peoples of the world, entrusting our survival to the mercy of monsters. The greatest damage the terrorists could ever inflict upon us is disarmament at the hands of the political elites. But we will never offer our right to survive as a fool's ransom to the world's killers. Our freedom is what they fear most. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to our program our friend S.E. Cupp. S.E., how you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thanks for joining us. So tomorrow's the big day in New York, and one of the big themes for Hillary Clinton, as she has been stumping around the state here, is the difference between her and Bernie Sanders on the issue of gun control. Now, in reality, SE, there's not much difference between her and Bernie Sanders when it comes to the issue of gun control. But Hillary Clinton has been making much ado about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, the fact that Bernie Sanders voted for this bill, and the fact that Bernie Sanders has held the apparently very controversial belief that you should not be able to hold third parties responsible for the actions of criminals.
Yeah, you know, look, Hillary Clinton has been looking for opportunities to differentiate herself from her socialist, you know, running mate, Bernie Sanders, and there aren't many, as you point out. And so she's really sort of scraping the bottom of the barrel for anything she can use to distinguish. And she's really made a lot of this. I mean, you know, out there on the stump, especially in New York, she has really talked a lot about how Bernie is somehow less sympathetic to the victims of the Sandy Hook shooting and other massacres than she is, because he stands for the very unremarkable premise that if you buy a product and use it unlawfully, you should the makers of that product should not be held criminally liable. And she's basically gone out there and spread total misinformation and lies to perpetuate this idea that Bernie Sanders is a blood-hungry, gun-toting madman, and she, of course, is Mother Teresa in this fight. And it just couldn't be further from the truth. There's very little truth to what she says about what this law does and doesn't do. And what's really unfortunate is that Bernie Sanders himself won't push back on it because he doesn't want to appear to be pro-gun. So even though Bernie Sanders knows that what she's saying is not true, he's, you know, happy to remain silent on it so that he's not painted as pro-gun any more than he has been by her.
Yeah, this is kind of fascinating, and it's one of those, you know, Machiavellian slash Clintonian moves here. Because, you know, one of Bernie Sanders' big appeals, SE, is his authenticity, right?
Yeah.
But here, he can't really be authentic. He can't really talk about what he thinks because he has to try to appeal to that anti-gun Democratic primary base. Although I will note, I think Sanders actually could. I think he could stick to his guns, no pun intended, and be authentic. You know, you look at the number of states that Bernie Sanders has won, I don't think it would help him in New York, honestly. But nationwide, right, I think that it would help. He won 8 straight contests going into New York. Hillary Clinton was on the gun control stump the entire time. It didn't help her in Wisconsin. Certainly didn't help her in places like Wyoming. And, you know, the bottom line, as you say, is Hillary Clinton's being very dishonest here. In your piece in the New York Daily News, you quote tort law expert Victor Schwartz, right, who says the legislation stands for the unremarkable premise that when a business makes or sells a lawful product, but the product is used in an unlawful way, namely by a criminal, it is not the fault of the maker or seller. It is the fault of the criminal. You know, what's fascinating is that Hillary Clinton has actually got the really controversial viewpoint here that, no, that standard's not accurate. You should be able to hold third parties accountable for what a criminal does.
Well, yeah, and if Bernie really had the courage, he would point this out. Look, this law is neither controversial. It was passed in 2005 with the support of more than a dozen Democrats in the Senate. It was co-authored by a Democrat. It has stood up to countless court challenges. It's a bipartisan. It's got bipartisan support for the fact that, look, this would set a very dangerous precedent if we allowed people to, for example, sue car companies when criminals used cars in committing crimes. This just makes no sense. And what Bernie has said is, look, what you're really talking about, if you want to repeal this law, is ending gun manufacturing in America, and he doesn't agree with that. And that is exactly what this law, repealing this law, would do. It would essentially end gun manufacturing. It's sort of a roundabout way of gun control. And Hillary Clinton knows this. But Bernie Sanders will not point out that she is lying through her teeth with a straight face over and over and over again about what the law does. The law does not prohibit gun manufacturers or dealers from ever being sued. They can be sued for a whole lot of things, and that happens all the time. Nor is it true that the gun industry is the only industry that is sort of above these criminal protections. That is not true either. There are plenty of other industries which you cannot sue for unlawful use. I just pointed one out, the car industry.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing she has said is true about this. And you don't have to believe me. PolitiFact is rating her claims as false, too. And if Bernie Sanders really had the convictions he talks about, he'd point that out. But I think, as you point out, with New York coming up, he doesn't think it does him any favors to be the person sticking up for this not controversial act.
Yeah, no, you're right. And unfortunately, like here, if I were advising the Bernie Sanders campaign, which I am not, but you know, you talk about the car industry. Let's talk about the pharmaceutical industry for a second, SC.
Right.
Seriously, there were, according to the CDC, in 2013, 22,134 overdose deaths due to pharmaceutical drugs, almost 17,000 opioid analgesics that led to a death by overdose. That's more than the number of homicides in the United States in 2013. So, by Hillary Clinton's logic, should we be able to sue the pharmaceutical companies that she's received millions from, by the way, in campaign
right.
donations already? Should we be able to sue the pharmaceutical companies under the theory that they are marketing these opioid-based pills, knowing that a certain portion of that market is going to get diverted into the black market, is going to lead to overdose deaths? Why is that theory any different? Why would we not be able to sue Big Pharma for the opioid epidemic if we're going to sue fire manufacturers for violent crime in this country?
Or liquor manufacturers, bartenders. I mean, it's really absurd, but you and I are having a rational conversation about this. What's not happening, and I was at the New York debate in Brooklyn last week, covering it for CNN. What is not happening is a logical, rational debate on guns on the left. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders said the most illogical, irrational, and inaccurate things about guns, and then the debate moved on to the next issue. He's saying we need an assault weapons ban again to basically solve for the less than 2% of gun crimes committed every year, right? By
yeah.
banning assault weapons. Something that did not lower crime when it was tried the first time, and something I hope gets repeated in a general election. I really do, because it's that unpopular.
Oh, it's coming. You'll get your wish.
Oh, I know. And she's spreading these lies about a non-controversial protection bill that Democrats even think is okay. So there's no, you and I can have a rational conversation about why this is dumb or why this is ineffective or why this is unworkable, but it doesn't really matter because we're speaking a totally different language. Over on the left, it is a fact-free diet when it comes to talking about guns. And it's unfortunate because if anyone were going to hold Hillary Clinton or any other Democrat responsible for the lies that they're telling about guns, it could be someone like Bernie Sanders, who at least seems to have an understanding of what pro-gun constituents want, even if he, you know, disagrees with it personally. And to see him just allow these lies to be repeated on a debate stage, at a campaign rally, in campaign literature, and to allow her to exploit this tragedy, and meanwhile, really take down his character and integrity in the process, it's just really disappointing. Kirsten Gillibrand, Hillary Clinton's junior senator from New York, mm-hmm. a former colleague in the Senate, basically has told Politico that Bernie Sanders lacks the sensitivity to understand how gun violence devastates families. That is a disgusting charge, that just because Bernie Sanders doesn't want to sign meaningless legislation that will not prohibit future gun crimes or repeal legislation that protects an entire industry does not mean he doesn't get how violence impacts families. That is absurd, and it is disgusting. And you just wish Bernie Sanders would stand up to it.
Yeah, but he won't. I mean, and this is, no. I think, sort of been a theme throughout his candidacy. There are certain lines that, for whatever reason, Bernie Sanders doesn't want to cross. He didn't want to talk about Hillary Clinton's email or her private server, right? That's just enough of the damn emails, he said.
Right,
exactly. And so you're right. I mean, even when it's the attack on character, There's that acquiescence to, you know, the reality of the facts on the ground. It's actually, you know, it's interesting. Vermont's Governor Peter Shumlin, who is a Clinton superdelegate, has pushed back, I think, at least as much, if not more, on Hillary Clinton's claim that, you know, New York is being flooded by these guns from Vermont.
Vermont guns, yeah.
Right. And have you noticed this as well, S.E.? This is a new thing for Hillary Clinton. She said this at least three or four times. She said it in the debate in Brooklyn. Guns from Vermont committing crimes in New York. It's not a person committing the crime. She actually says it's guns from Vermont that are coming down and committing crimes in New York. Apparently they're flowing on a river of sap from, you know, the maple trees there. I don't know how they're getting to New York, but they're going there and they're committing crimes, and then I don't know if they're returning back home to Vermont. But, you know, this is the type of nonsense that, you're right, is not really being challenged here.
It's nonsense, and it, you know, it always is, but in an election year in particular, the nonsense that these guys are getting away with is kind of even more just mind-boggling. And it's really sad because no one is more concerned about ending gun crime than lawful gun users and law-abiding gun owners. Mm-hmm. You know, we care just as much. But when only one of us is using facts to try and have that conversation, it makes the conversation a non-starter. You can't have a conversation about ending gun violence or reducing gun violence with someone who thinks that a gun without a person is responsible for the gun violence. I mean, it's just, it makes no sense. We're not working with honest brokers here. And it's amazing because, you know, the gun control groups would have you believe that pro-gun lobby is this, you know, evil corporate, massive, shadowy, dark group. Well, what do you think gun control is? It's a lobby as much as anything else is, with people who are paid to you know, twist politicians' arms and get the legislation that they want. It's just, without any honesty and transparency about what's happening with the debate over gun control, and a presidential election is the worst time to have this conversation, we might as well just all stay home, because there's not going to be any progress. There's not going to be any coming to understandings. There's not even going to be any teaching the other side, you know, here's what this law is actually about, or here's what that language actually means when you use it. It's pointless. It's pointless until they want to have an actual honest conversation.
Well, in the meantime, you got to keep trying, and I appreciate what you wrote in the New York Daily News. And I'll be honest with you, S.E., I appreciate the New York Daily News actually allowing you to appear on the pages, because I know they're not real fans of the right to keep and bear arms. So tip of the cap to them as well. S.E., thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. S.E. Cupp, you can find her on Twitter at S.E. Cupp, online at thesecupp.com. Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner joining us in just a few minutes, talking more about the New York primary. It is coming up tomorrow. The Washington Examiner's Dan Friedman has a piece on the latest attacks by Hillary Clinton. Loose gun laws, supposedly, is what she was attacking. She said, quote, guns are not the answer to anything. They are the answer to nothing except pain and heartbreak and ruined lives. Her Secret Service contingent could not be reached for comment. Clinton's appeal for stronger gun laws plays well in New York. The Washington Examiner writes, which holds its presidential primary on Tuesday. But she has also touted the issue more aggressively than Democratic candidates who mostly avoided the issue in the last four presidential campaigns. The Examiner says Clinton herself had less to say on gun violence during her 2008 campaign. No. It wasn't that she had less to say. She had something completely different to say in 2008. In 2016, Hillary Clinton says, listen, we need federal gun control laws. We got to do something here. In 2008, Hillary Clinton said, you know, what works in Manhattan might not work in Montana, and vice versa. So I don't think this needs to be handled at the federal level. I think, you know, the states can figure this out. 8 years later, she's completely reversed course. Doesn't want to talk about it. The Examiner says Clinton also appears to be betting that strong support in both parties for, quote, tougher background checks rules will make gun control an issue that at least does not hurt with swing voters while helping to turn out Democratic base voters in November. You know, again, I think one of the strongest pushbacks to this idea is actually going to come from law enforcement, like we're seeing in California. like we've seen in Oregon and in Washington State and elsewhere, the people who are actually charged with enforcing these new laws say this is not where we should be going. Again, it's easy for a lawmaker to say we have to do something, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to propose a law. But after they've proposed the law, after they if they manage to, you know, shepherd it through the legislature and it becomes law, their job is done. Oftentimes, they don't even have to do that. They just have to propose a bill, and they've done something. But it's the law enforcement officers, again, from the cops on the street to the prosecutors, who actually have to try to make this law work in practice. And when you talk with sheriffs around the country, and there are a lot of sheriffs, I think, that are more willing to speak up publicly about this. Again, they'll tell you, listen, we've got the budget to investigate. There was the sheriff in Oregon that we talked to right after their universal background check law went into effect. And he said, we don't have the budget to put deputies on the street 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We don't have 24/7 coverage. 20 hours a day. That's what we have. And then if there's an accident, if there's something that happens in that four-hour gap, a deputy has to get up, go put on the uniform, and they have to leave their house and then go to that call. He said, we don't have the budget to investigate anything other than crimes of violence against persons. So you ask me, is this law enforceable? I don't see how. Even if I had the money, I don't see how I could enforce it. But if you ask me if I'm going to enforce it, I can't. There's no way that I can do this. And when you tell me that this has to be one of my big priorities, what do I drop in exchange? Now, again, this might be one of the big campaign issues here, is reality versus fantasy. The fantasy of, oh, you know, if we just have a couple more of these quote-unquote common sense gun safety laws, it won't be won't really impact anybody but the bad guys, even though they're aimed at the law-abiding gun owners, have a major impact on those criminals, and won't, you know, cost any sort of money, won't be any unforeseen consequences, versus the reality of what it means to push these laws, again, that are aimed at people who are not committing violent crimes in the purported attempt to reduce violent crime. I will confess to being a little concerned about how reality will fare versus fantasy in this election year. But doesn't mean I'm not going to fight for reality. And hope that you'll do the same. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return here on NRA News Cam and Company, Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner joins us. Stick around. We've got more for you coming up after this quick break. Now I want to welcome to the program from the Pink Pistols out in California. Nikki Stollett is with us. I read with great interest your piece of the Fresno Bee, sort of an open letter to Gavin Newsom on the anti-gun efforts of the lieutenant governor. What made you decide that you wanted to write this, Nikki?
Well, I've always been strongly for the whole Bill of Rights, but especially our Second Amendment. And Gavin portrays himself as a civil rights libertarian type person. But what made me write this is because, you know, Gavin, the Bill of Rights is a package deal. And attacking the Second Amendment is just wrong. So you can't be saying that you're for rights on one hand and destroying rights on the other. Rights are a package deal. He's a big saying, I'm pro-choice this, I'm pro-choice that. Well, hey, you know, rights are rights, and you don't get to pick and choose.
No, you don't. And, you know, you talk in your piece in Fresno about violent crime against particularly threats to the LGBT community. You say that in West Hollywood, I did not know this, in 2014, West Hollywood had the highest violent crime rate of any of the 23 districts patrolled by the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, 98% higher than South Los Angeles, 38% higher than Compton. Nikki, I'm guessing there are a lot of people who are really, really just as surprised as I was to learn those figures. And your point is that, look, here is a community that is at risk, and your the attitude of Gavin Newsom is, let's make sure that none of them are law-abiding legal gun owners.
Oh, I agreed. In fact, when we actually had the numbers crunched, I myself was actually shocked, especially 30% higher than Compton. I mean, Compton is the hood, you know? And to think that, you know, West Hollywood, an area that you'd think that, oh, it's, you know, it's right next to Hollywood up there near Beverly Hills, and we have all this violence actually going on. It's like, hey, you know what the beep?
It is, like I said, it was surprising to me. We're talking with Nikki Stollard of the Pink Pistols. And Nikki, so I'm curious, what type of response has your column gotten in the LGBT community? Because, look, I know, you know, there is no stereotypical gun owner in this country, not even in California. But I also know a lot of people, Chris Chang actually said, you know, he got more grief for coming out as a gun owner among his friends and family than he did when he came out as gay.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. A lot depends on where you are at in California. Okay, right now I'm in the Central Valley, of course. In Central Valley, California, gun rights are, by California standards, very well respected.
Mm-hmm.
For the longest time, I was in San Jose. I still go back there, but I was running the San Jose Pink Pistol chapter. And overall, the gay community was, we'll say, lukewarm, although more and more coming around to my position. In San Francisco, where my friend Tom Boyer runs the San Francisco Pink Pistols, he's got a lot of open hostility from the gay community. But surprisingly, we think things are changing because we actually marched in the San Francisco Pride Parade, not once, but actually seven times. And we were expecting, in all honesty, to get booed and have stuff thrown at us, marching all the way down. I mean, the biggest gay pride parade in the country. And surprisingly, we've actually been well received. So it's kind of hard to put a peg in it where people really feel individually. Now, of course, their leadership, the people, self-appointed leaders of the LGBT community tend to lean towards progressive politics, and of course, progressive politics promotes big government dependence on government. So the last thing they want is for the sheep to be armed.
Talking again with Nikki Stollard of the Pink Pistols, and it is, you know, you write in your piece how you say it's a refreshing change to see our fellow citizens unite to protect our civil liberties. And, you know, we really are seeing a broad coalition develop there in California, Nikki. I mean, everybody from Pink Pistols members to prosecutors, to sheriffs, to competitive shooters, to, you know, law-abiding gun owners. I mean, you've got a really broad coalition coming out and saying this is wrong for California.
Oh, absolutely.
It's NRA News, Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Tuesday, primary day in New York State. Want to welcome to the program from the Washington Examiner. You can find him online at Michael Barone on Twitter, Mr. Michael Barone himself. How you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us today. So tomorrow is the big day in New York State. All polling would seem to indicate that Donald Trump enjoys a sizable lead here, as does Hillary Clinton over on the Democratic side. I know that you and I have been talking throughout the primary season, Michael. Any surprises you think in store tomorrow?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the polling and you look at the results of the primary so far, New York, Donald Trump's home state, seems to be his strongest state. I mean, he hasn't gotten 50% in any primary that's been held, or caucus that's been held to date. But he's been polling at or over 50% in every poll that's been conducted since March 2015, 3 months before he declared his candidacy, with the single exception of one where he's at 49%. No statistical significance in the difference between 50% there. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a big time for Donald Trump. And in my column in the Washington Examiner, I speculated on the idea that this is kind of New York exceptionalism. I took note of the fact that Trump, you know, who grew up in Queens, the outer boroughs of New York, in a very nice neighborhood in Queens with winding streets and big houses, but nonetheless, the outer boroughs, as they say, and who speaks in New York accents and with New York intonations and talks about people waiting online rather than people waiting in line, as Americans from everywhere but New York say, that he struck a chord with the 23% of New York voters who are registered Republicans. So he seems likely to win. The key question is the delegate hall. New York has 95 delegates. The rules are that the 14 elected statewide and the 3 elected from each of the 27 congressional districts are split proportionally, except if one candidate gets 50% in statewide or by congressional district, that candidate gets all the delegates. So that means that there's about 7 delegates statewide at stake based on whether or not Trump gets 50% or more, and there are as many as 20-some delegates at stake for a second-place finisher who must get more than 20%. But if Trump doesn't get 50 and there are only 3 candidates, second-place finisher is surely going to be over 20% just about every case. That and those, you know, that can make a difference as to whether or not Trump gets 1237 after the end, last contest, June 7th.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this could be a end up being a huge haul for Donald Trump tomorrow night.
That 1237 is not, by the way, as Trump suggests, some arbitrary number that was picked out of the air. It's called a majority.
Talking again with Michael Verona of the Washington Examiner. I've got to tell you as well, Michael, I thoroughly enjoyed the reference to one of my favorite historians, David Hackett Fisher, in his book Albion Seed in your column. Since today is April 18th, I feel like I should also plug David Hackett Fisher's Paul Revere's Ride, which I thought was a fantastic book.
Well, and in Massachusetts and Maine, which until 1820 was part of Massachusetts, it is Patriots Day.
It is indeed.
So let's cheer for our fellow Americans in Massachusetts and Maine, even though they may differ with us on some issues. We're celebrating Patriots Day and the running of the Boston Marathon.
Yes, sir. And there are still plenty of Patriots up there in Massachusetts. Although I don't know if you saw the news recently where someone in Lexington, Massachusetts, wanted to use the town meeting to actually call for a gun ban there in the town, which seems kind of opposed to the nation, to the town's history there.
The 18th of April in 75, there's hardly a man now alive. Well, I'll leave it off at there.
Michael Barone, thank you.
My grandmother could do the whole poem.
Right, and we just look it up. We Google it. Michael, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's always a pleasure, sir.
My pleasure. Take
Michael
care.
Barone, join us again. You can find him on Twitter, at Michael Barone. Brian Lilly coming up next hour. Bob Aldridge, a firearms instructor with Indiana Firearms Training, in a war of words with his local paper over the assertion that just a few simple gun laws could lead to a dramatic reduction in the violent crime rates in this country. Now, we've been following the issue of a campus carry around the country. I told you earlier what's going on at the University of Georgia. We've got poets, apparently, against campus carry that are really pushing hard for a Twitter bombing of Governor Nathan Deal in opposition to campus carry on Wednesday. Also in Georgia, the website Better Georgia has a piece by Timothy Lewis, who is a college student at a private institution there in Georgia. He says, campus carry legislation poses a threat to the positive college experiences of my friends and fellow students at public institutions. So why is that? He says, here are three of the many reasons that guns on campus will make universities less safe. Number one, college students, he says, are reporting more issues of mental health problems than ever before. Adding guns to the equation could result in increased suicide rates and more attacks. Two, he says, in an emergency, students carrying guns create a confusing situation for campus police. How will police be able to tell a good guy with a gun from a bad guy with a gun? Governor Deal may not be impressed with the Wild West scenario argument, but the possibility is very real. Guns on campus can lead to more injuries than lives saved, he says. And the third reason, an important part of higher education is having a student's own views challenged by professors and other students. Colleges are a place for opinions to be developed, challenged, and defended. Campus carry laws could incite justified fear in students and professors who have conflicting, possible provoking opinions in the classroom. Campus carry laws not only pose a physical threat, but an educational threat as well. Now, again, not mentioned in this piece at bettergeorgia.org is what has happened in those states that have adopted, and in some cases adopted years ago, campus carry policies. Have any of these concerns come to pass? And the answer is no, they haven't. You have not seen a Wild West mentality develop. You have not seen an increase in suicides. You have not seen gunfights erupt in college classrooms because a student disagreed with a professor. You haven't seen these things. I understand the appeal of the nakedly emotional argument. I do. I get it. But when you are a college student or a college professor, and you are writing about an issue that's coming to your college campus, don't you want to look? Don't you need to look? Aren't you taught to look for empirical evidence? Isn't that the first place that you would go? Okay, what's happened? Where these laws have been put in place, what has happened? Now, admittedly, you know, you couldn't point to any of those problems that you fear will develop if campus carry is passed, because they haven't occurred on other campuses. But we don't even get that. Instead, we get the absurdity of the campus carry law shows another important phenomena in the current political state. Legislatures are being drawn to extremes, he says. This bill passed in both the House and the Senate along party line votes. Being an election year, Republicans couldn't possibly vote no to pro-gun legislation for fear of losing their seats. That should be nothing compared, he says, to the dangers posed by college students carrying guns in classrooms, libraries, daycares, and just about everywhere else. Again, these college students are also concealed carry holders, and they are already carrying throughout the state of Georgia every day. This college student, Timothy Lewis, says he attends a private college. I assume leaves that campus at some point in time. I assume he is out there in the open society on occasion, in which case he too is interacting with concealed carry holders there in the state of Georgia. You know, the arguments, again, that we hear about campus carry primarily translate to, I don't like the carrying of firearms for self-defense. They're not really campus carry arguments. They're arguments against the carrying of firearms generally. But again, around the country, we have, what, 43 states that are now shall issue? We have not seen a single state around the country move to repeal or get rid of its concealed carry law once it's gone into effect. Not one. We now have over 13 million concealed carry holders in this country. And I imagine by the end of the year, we'll have over 14 million. In fact, I just saw a story out of Wisconsin earlier today. The state has hit the 300,000 mark in terms of concealed carry holders. And remember, Wisconsin was the 49th state in the union to get a concealed carry law on the books. For a number of years, it was a running contest. Which state would be the last state not to have a concealed carry law? Would it be Wisconsin? Would it be Illinois? And it was not the cheese standing alone. When all was said and done, it was Illinois, the last state in the union to adopt a concealed carry law. And the state of Illinois adopted a shall issue concealed carry law because, again, majority of states, that is the case. The Badger Herald newspaper there at the University of Wisconsin, Emily Hammer with the story, says, according to a January 2016 Marquette Law School poll, 63% of Wisconsin residents support concealed carry. 31% are opposed. Law's pretty popular. Michael Wagner, University of Wisconsin journalism and mass comm professor, says concealed carry impacts almost every Wisconsinite. He said, quote, if you're in a room of 30 people, somewhere between two or three are probably armed. That's just something that might give people pause when they're out in the community. So stay in your home, apparently. Holy cow. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzlers, coming up right after this. Quick timeout.
Speaking with Joe Fiala with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. Joe, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stopping by. You got a lot of stuff going on. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do in the Governor's Office of Economic Development there in South Dakota and why you do it. So tell us a little bit about what the office is all about and what you have going on.
Sure. So we're all about growing business in the state or attracting business to the state. And in my specific instance, I get to work with all of the companies in the shooting, hunting, and outdoor industry. So everything from firearms and ammunition to duck calls and fishing rods.
Wow, Joe, can we say dream job here?
Yeah, you can.
And it's great in South Dakota. There's an office to do this. Because, you know, Joe, in sort of, and some states would say, I won't mention names, you know, it's okay. Maybe we'll keep you at arm's length. We love your taxes. But you guys are showing in a very overt way here, welcoming industries like this.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good fit for the state in a couple of ways. And here's a couple of examples. We've got about 850,000 people in the state. And we issued 350,000 hunting licenses last year.
Say that again. Hold on.
Yeah. So we've got about 850,000 people in the state, and we issued 350,000 hunting licenses.
Wow. Dude, that is incredible.
Yeah. So this industry is a really good fit for the state. It's just culturally what we do, who we are.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, let's talk about that for a minute. I just was talking with some other folks here. And for people who are non-hunters and don't understand, it's part of a lifestyle, you know. It's part of, you know, who we are and what we do.
That's exactly right. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and my mom, and we'd go out hunting, and now I get to teach my kids that same thing.
Right.
And it's about family time. It's about, you know, hunting for your table.
Yeah.
In some instances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's about the sportsmanship.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Joe, whether you grew up, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Hunting's big there. The day after Thanksgiving, when I grew up, it wasn't about going out Black Friday and shopping. It was going out deer hunting.
Exactly.
Or you grew up in South Dakota. That's just part of what our DNA is. Speaking with Joe Fiala, he is with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff, some of the folks you've been working with. Name some of the companies.
Right. So, you know, some of the South Dakota companies that have been longtime residents that continue to grow, you hear Dakota Arms.
Right.
Certainly. Black Hills Ammunition.
Absolutely.
Corbin Ammunition. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got some of the players that have been around a long time. One of our newest corporate citizens to the state is a company out of Pennsylvania. It's called Lehigh Defense.
Okay. I've
heard them.
Yep.
They are expanding to the state. And so it's a great fit. They're going to make bullets. And we'll use them.
How great is that? A company in Pennsylvania is expanding out to South Dakota.
Right.
How great is that?
Right.
All right, so we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have to wrap it up. So I want you to sort of give folks the message why they need to be, if they're in those particular industries you mentioned before, why do they need to bring their business to South Dakota?
Sure. A couple of things. One, we're a very low-tax state, which means we want the business owner to keep their money. OK, Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. Second thing is Forbes rated us number one as the lowest cost of business state in 2015.
That's nice, too.
Right. So it doesn't cost a lot to do business. And then the cultural fit that we talked about, it just works. And we want to grow that business in our state.
How can people get more information about what you do?
Right. They can go to our website. It's sdreadytowork.com.
Great.
And then for my specific industry, you put a slash and shot.
Joe, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company is on the air right now. Brian Lilly of the Rebel and the Blaze join us in just a little bit. Bob Aldridge, firearms instructor, part of Indiana Firearms Training, will join us later in the hour as well. We've got Mr. Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom next hour. Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. Perhaps more evidence that Hillary Clinton's anti-gun attacks on Bernie Sanders aren't paying off the way she was expecting them to. Her handlers were expecting them to. Maybe Michael Bloomberg was expecting them to. A new NBC Wall Street Journal poll. Hillary Clinton leads Bernie Sanders by just 2 points nationwide, 50% to 48%. Mark Burry from NBC says that's down from Clinton 53%, Sanders 44% last month. Huh. Imagine that. Hillary Clinton goes after Bernie Sanders as being pro-gun when he's not, and rather than Bernie Sanders tanking, again, among Democratic primary voters, the opposite appears to be occurring. All right, so before we took a timeout, we were discussing this piece of the Badger Herald newspaper on Wisconsinites carrying firearms, some 300,000 Wisconsinites with concealed carry licenses, and gave me that quote by the University of Wisconsin Journalism and Mass Comm Professor Michael Wagner, perfectly illustrating what it was we were talking about last hour with campus carry. The arguments against campus carry are ultimately arguments against concealed carry, generally. Michael Wagner, upon hearing that, 8% of the population there in Wisconsin are concealed carry holders, says, quote, "That's just something that might give people pause when they're out in the community. I don't know about this." Do you think Michael Wagner has covered how many concealed carry holders have committed violent crimes, the revocation rate for concealed carry holders in the state of Wisconsin, anything like that, that, again, might provide some sort of empirical evidence as to whether or not you should be paused when you go out into the community? The Badger Herald quotes Representative Chris Taylor, Democrat from Madison, Wisconsin, said she believes the number of permits that have been issued is significant and, quote, alarming. Alarming that people are exercising their right to keep and bear arms. She says the Department of Justice has had to add eight new positions just to process the new permit requests. Well, I would think that elected representative from Madison, Wisconsin, would be happy about the size of government getting bigger by at least eight people. Representative Taylor says research shows most of the time victims of crimes do not get the chance to use guns to defend themselves. She says it's more often the case that guns get turned against them. Really? I would love to hear more about that, given that we don't see, let's say, a million crimes per year committed against concealed carry holders where their firearm is taken away from them. But research would indicate that they're somewhere between 100,000 to 2.5 million defensive gun uses every year. I use the 1 million figure because it's roughly in the middle. Also came from a Clinton era Justice Department study. Now, I would imagine that, again, with the number of concealed carry holders having increased dramatically since then, that the number has actually grown. But any way you slice it, any set of stats that you want to use, there are far more defensive gun uses in this country than there are crimes committed against concealed carry holders with their own firearms. But this, again, is the the type of arguing that we get from supposedly bright academics. Representative Taylor also said that Milwaukee law enforcement leaders have tied Wisconsin's concealed carry law to a decade high of homicides seen in Milwaukee in 2015. This actually was a story December of 2015. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn said, since that law has passed almost every single year, the number of crime guns seized by this department has gone up and the time to crime on our most frequently used weapons has decreased. He says, now that's correlation, not causation, but it's a pretty strong correlation. You know, what would provide even stronger correlation would be the number of concealed carry holders who were arrested for a violent crime in Milwaukee. But the chief didn't talk about that. The Journal Sentinel reported back in December, since 2011, when Wisconsin's concealed carry law was approved, Milwaukee police have recovered more guns nearly every year, with a 20% increase from 2013 to 2014. Nearly every year, by the way. Note the weasel words. Almost every year since 2011, we've collected more guns than the year before. I wonder, how many years did that not happen? I also wonder, could you go back to, let's say, the 6 or 7 years before the state of Wisconsin passed concealed carry? And did the Milwaukee Police Department seize more firearms year per year over that period of time before the concealed carry law took effect? The Journal Sentinel, again, didn't say. And they did not, again, nothing in this article about the number of concealed carry holders arrested, which is pretty amazing. This was Ashley Lutheran of the Journal Sentinel who wrote this piece. Just quoting the chief there. Again, no follow-up questions, apparently. No pushback. No, hey, chief, if concealed carry holders really are responsible for the spike in violent crime, how many did you arrest for violent crimes last year? Oh, sort of on a related note, the Associated Press with a story out today showing that America's trust in the media is down to 6%. Yeah, 6. Like single digits, 6% of Americans say that they have a lot of confidence in the media. Wow. This is part of the Media Insight Project, a partnership of the Associated Press, NROC, Center for Public Affairs Research, and the American Press Institute. Nearly 90% of Americans say it's extremely or very important that the media get their facts correct, according to the study. About 4 in 10 say that they can remember a specific incident that eroded their confidence in the media, most often one that dealt with accuracy or a perception that it was one-sided. Yeah, kind of see that every day here if you are paying attention to Second Amendment issues. Margaret Sullivan, the public editor of the New York Times, says the most important thing that news organizations can do is be accurate. And while we know that that is a high value, this study reinforces that. Even if it goes against the competitive push to be first, she said, quote, perhaps there has to be a willingness to wait a little bit to be right. Well, you know, look, we've talked about this before. When there is a breaking news event right now, there is this zone of confusion that lasts anywhere for a couple of hours to, you know, a half a day or more, as facts on the ground are slow to arrive. The media, whether it's the broadcast media or increasingly the print media, whether that's online or on trees, they are interested in pushing content out immediately, even when there's not a lot of information. As a result, that's where you get the speculation. That's where you get stories that have to be amended or retracted, corrections issued. And here's the thing. When she says, perhaps there has to be a willingness to wait a little bit to be right. Good luck with that. I mean, look, that's the ethos and the philosophy that guides us here at NRA News, Cam and Company. But you're bucking the trend if you think that, you know, the major networks, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, are all going to decide amongst themselves or together that, you know what, maybe it's not important to be first with the story. Maybe it's more important that we hold off, make sure that we've got all of our ducks in the row, and then hit publish, or then we decide that we're going to break in with coverage. It's not going to happen. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it is not going to happen. The study found that about 6 in 10 Americans watch, read, or hear news several times a day. A majority of people get news from social media, most frequently by far from Facebook. One of the authors of this study said Facebook is the place where everyone is, and so you're not necessarily looking for news, but you're getting it. Yet only 12% of those who use Facebook say that they have a lot of trust in the news and information that they see on the site. Again, double the percentage of Americans who have trust or faith in the media more generally, but still an abysmally low number. Twitter attracts smaller numbers for news than Facebook, and about 18% have a good deal of trust in what they read there. There's also viewer skepticism of other social media sites, according to the AP. But again, 6% of Americans say they have trust or faith in the media. I'm a little surprised that it is that high, particularly when you see the types of stories that we see every day here just on this one issue. Now, see, that's the thing. I can tell, I think, generally, when a reporter has gotten something wrong when it comes to a Second Amendment-related issue. But there are plenty of subjects out there where I would have no idea if a reporter got it wrong, because I don't have the institutional knowledge or the personal expertise to fact check the reporter. And this is one of the real issues that we have in terms of our trust being eroded. Once that is gone, I don't know how easy it is for the media to get it back, quite frankly. More and more, I'm kind of wondering if that's even a priority for the media to want that trust back. Do you need that trust? Or do you just need the click-throughs? Do you just need the eyeballs tuning in to hear whatever controversial statement is going to be said? Is journalism about the facts, or is journalism about getting as large an audience, however you have to do it? Because I'll be honest with you, you look around at the state of media today, and a lot of it seems designed to get us to watch, not necessarily designed to inform us. But there is still occasionally some real journalism being done. Our friend Brian Lilly is going to join us here in a couple of minutes talking about a story out of Canada from the province. Criminals now getting their guns in Canada. Yeah. Why, again, it's almost like you can have whatever gun control laws on the books you want, but the people who desire to illegally obtain, possess, and use those things, they will find a way. A black market will be created. And, again, maybe the idea of going after the supply of lawfully owned firearms to reduce violent crime is not as not as good an idea, at least in terms of, again, reducing violent crime, than reducing the demand for illegally obtained and possessed and used firearms. But yeah, we'll talk about that with Brian Lilly coming up in just a couple of minutes. Also, later on in the hour, I want to talk about another very violent weekend in Chicago. So we've got a lot on our plate this hour. Stick around. There's much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know the truth about Benghazi. I was there, fighting alongside five Americans who were all raised to believe that if you have a chance to save someone's life and you don't try, that's more criminal than anything else. So we fought for 13 hours and we saved lives. But we are not unique. We are no different than the Americans who ran back into those crumbling New York towers, or the Americans who tackled the armed terrorists on that French train, or the many faceless, nameless Americans who every day risk their lives for perfect strangers trapped in burning cars or dangerous waters. Because if they didn't, no one would. Where was that courage among the politicians who had the power to make a difference during those 13 hours in Benghazi? I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. It has all been done, but we're going to do it again. Brian Lilly of the Rebel in the Blaze joins us one more time, at least one more time. I'm guessing probably this is not the last appearance by Brian. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing perfectly well, you know, just relaxing on a beautiful afternoon here in Ottawa with my good friend Corey, who's an NRA member. He just told me when the phone went, he said, yeah, I just renewed while I was down at SHOT Show.
That is awesome. And I'm sure that there are Canadians everywhere horrified to learn that, in fact, there are Canadian members of the National Rifle Association.
Oh, there are plenty. And I know I've mentioned her before, Eva Shockey, her dad, Jim Shockey, mm-hmm. Hunting legend. I mean, they're all big, big supporters. And they're all Canadian. I mean, she lives down in the States now, but they're all Canadian. And lots of big supporters. I was just out at the range yesterday. My boys took them out for the first time. And I got to tell you, I got a couple of budding marksmen on my hands.
That is awesome. This was their first time ever?
Well, first time at an official range, as opposed to just in the back 40 with a 22 plinking off some clay targets in the ground. So, I mean, they were out with, friend took us out a full complement of 308, an old SKS, and yeah, when they're hitting dead center, their first time trying a nice 308, that makes me proud and tells me I better get them some proper training.
Absolutely. That is awesome, Brian. Congratulations. It always is a very fun moment as a dad to get to take your kids out there for the first time. And this is one of those memories, I think, that stay with you, stays with them. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Now, again, I'm sure that there are Canadians horrified that that you did such a thing, horrified that there are even ranges out there, because as is being reported in the province newspaper, criminals are now getting their guns in Canada, Brian. For years now, we've been hearing that one of the reasons why we need to have tougher gun laws, more restrictive gun laws here in the United States, is because guns from the United States are arming criminals. They're arming the cartels in Mexico. They're arming criminals in Canada. And now, actually, it looks like the police are saying, no, we're picking up more criminals who are getting their guns from right there in country.
You know, first off, let's be realistic, Cam. If Mexican drug cartels are getting their guns from American sources, we know who it is. It's Eric Holder, and he buys them and he outfits them and he puts in a AA battery and hopes that things go well. We know that didn't work out. But I am waiting for the data on this. We've asked for it. And right now, I'm hesitant to say I call BS on this completely. But for years, you're right, it has been upwards of 9% of the guns used by criminals have been smuggled into the country. And when you mention the province newspaper, that's in Vancouver, British Columbia. And so we're talking about guns being smuggled in either from the United States. You can drive and not even leave the Vancouver metropolitan area. You're in city the whole time, and then you're at the border with Washington State. So it's either coming in from the United States, or being that Vancouver is a, you know, Pacific port, they're coming in from Russia and China in terms of smuggling. So it's been upwards of 90%. Now they're saying almost 40% coming from Canadian domestic sources. I simply can't believe it. There are not that many guns that are being stolen out of the homes of law-abiding gun owners for that to happen. The penalties for, you know, legally buying guns and then turning around and selling them to criminals are quite high. And the process to get a gun license is fairly onerous. So, you know, I simply can't believe it, but, we'll wait and see what they come up with in terms of data to back that up. Right now, it just might be one of these things that police claim because they think it sounds good. We had the similar claim here in Ottawa that you shouldn't tell people that you have guns because then your home will be broken into and there's all these domestic sourcings. We asked them for the data. They couldn't back it up.
Interesting. Now, yeah, the story in the province talks about the Combined Forces Special Enforcement Unit. They're working, quote, with the Surrey RCMP and another law enforcement group in West on a new safe city project. Brian, where they visit the owners of restricted and prohibited firearms whose registrations have expired. And if the owner no longer wants their firearm, police take it. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, this is going to help with dealing with gangbangers who are running around with handguns by dropping by and picking up someone's AR-15 when their paperwork is expired. You know, how many gangsters are using AR-15s in holdups and shootouts? Generally, they tend to be the guys with a pistol and they're holding it sideways and not aiming properly. It's why I can't speak for Surrey. I think Surrey's had 32 shootings so far this year. That's a lot for Surrey, but it's called Friday Night in Chicago. But the fact is, often these guys, they don't die because they're such bad shots.
Talking again with Brian Lilly of the Rebel and the Blaze. And are you seeing, you know, we've seen in some cities anyway in the United States, Brian, an increase in violent crime. Violence way up in Chicago this year. Last year, homicides were up in Milwaukee and in Baltimore. I think stabbings are up in New York City this year. Are you seeing any similar sort of trend? Are there concerns that violent crime is on the increase in Canada?
Well, here in Ottawa, we've definitely had an uptick. In Surrey as well, in both cases. And I can't speak for every municipality. I don't think it's up in Toronto, the biggest city. But in various cities, it's gone up, and it's generally been related to the drug trade. In both Surrey and Ottawa, it's not even large-scale organized crime. It tends to be low-level street hoods, as I said, shooting each other. That's what's driving it. And so the same people that are calling for tougher gun laws to crack down on law-abiding gun owners and more gun control are generally the same people that are calling for acceptance of drugs, which is driving the gun violence. So it's, you know, they want more openness about drugs. The drug dealers fill the demand. Then they start shooting each other over turf wars, and so they decide to take guns away from law-abiding people. I'm not sure how that makes sense.
You know, I think if you're looking for a consistent, logical argument, Brian, you're not really going to get one. Because, again, I mean, as you say, this is one of the big problems that, you know, we're pointing out with the push for new gun regulations here in the United States. These are aimed at law-abiding gun owners. These are aimed at people who are willing to jump through all of the hoops and hurdles and navigate the maze of red tape that it takes to become a gun owner in Canada. If the onus is always on the law-abiding gun owner, restricting their sphere of liberty further and further, and meanwhile you ignore the actual criminals who are committing the violent crimes, is anybody shocked if violent crime goes up?
Yeah, we had debates about gun control at Canada's founding in the 1860s, 1870s, and our first prime minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, said, if you take guns away from the average person, then only the ruffians, I think was the term he used, only the ruffians will have them. And, well, guess what? That still applies today, and people don't learn. But it is because they know how to deal with law-abiding gun owners. They don't know what to do to deal with the criminals that have the guns. It's why I love the story Thomas Sowell has told about the police showing up at a building and the bank robbers run into the big building, but they don't have enough men to surround the big building, so they surround the one next door because it's smaller and they have enough men to surround that building. It doesn't work, but it's what they know how to do.
Do you see any hope? I mean, I know we've been talking with you about what's going on in Quebec, where there were plans, very, very vocal plans for a provincial gun registry, long gun registry, and then they started looking at the cost and started actually hearing from gun owners, and all of a sudden that push seemed to be on the back burner. What's the latest there, Brian?
Well, the push in Quebec is it continues, but the bigger threat for gun owners in Canada and the industry that our mutual friend Tony Bernardo keeps telling me about is the UN marking system. Canada is going to sign off on that and implement it, and he keeps saying this is going to have a huge impact on the gun industry in Canada. Will drive up costs, will drive up compliance, and you know, and it's one of those things that it just makes owning a firearm that much more difficult. It becomes a headache. And so, you know, to bring it back to the original story of the police in Surrey going to visit these guys who had licenses and then they let them lapse, maybe it's because they just get to a point where they say, you know what, this is becoming too much of a pain in the butt.
And that may be. And, you know, unfortunately, you just can't do that. Otherwise, it's going to be an even bigger pain in the butt when the police show up at your house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, don't let the paperwork lapse, but don't give up on owning guns either. It's going to be a dark few years. We elected the selfie prince back in October, and he's promised more gun control. We've got the province of Quebec promising more gun control, but luckily that's all so far. The other provinces don't seem too interested in pushing an agenda on that front, but definitely Justin Trudeau at the federal level will, and he's going to bring in some, you know, new requirements and reestablish some old ones over the next little while that just make owning a gun, taking it out to the range, taking it out to the hunt camp, all that much more difficult.
Absolutely. Brian, listen, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. It is always good talking with you. Folks can find you online, brianlilly.com. You're on the Twitters, right, as well, Brian Lilly?
Yep, I'm Brian Lilly for Twitter and Facebook.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bob Aldridge joins from Indiana Firearms Training coming up in just a little bit. Before we take a break, though, I'm just looking at a story here. This is from WINS 1010 in New York City. Juliet Papa, New York Police Department corruption probe. Feds arrest Brooklyn man who offered to pay cop $6,000 per gun permit he received. $6,000 to get a gun permit. Sources, at least 150 gun permits were obtained through a bribe scheme in the New York Police Department. This is a federal complaint now, by the way, that charges a Brooklyn man with paying bribes for gun permits. We'll be getting more details on this, but my first thought here is it's really hard to have corruption in these types of cases if you have a shall issue system. First of all, if you don't need permission to exercise a fundamental individual constitutional right, then you can't bribe someone in order to exercise said fundamental individual constitutional right. Can you? If you have to pay a fee, if you have to have a permit to speak your mind or publish a website in New York City, if you have to pay a fee or get a permission slip in order for you to speak in public, I imagine that there's going to be some opportunities for graft there, right? Oh, you want to speak? Okay. And I assume, by the way, this is a pistol permit, not a permit to carry. We'll try to get more details here. But again, this goes away. You don't have this problem if you actually recognize the right to keep and bear arms. If you don't have a permitting process, again, not a shall issue process, but a process in which you have to make multiple trips down to police department headquarters, multiple visits with investigators in order for you to legally own a firearm. A process that in New York City can take, 6 months? We've got listeners who've told us it's taken them over a year and hundreds of dollars in fees, legal fees, by the way, in order to exercise your right to keep and bear arms. So here's a simple proposal. Get rid of the gun permits in New York City. Don't require a permit to own a firearm in New York City. Abide by the words of the Second Amendment. And then you don't have an opportunity for corruption. You don't have an opportunity for graft or bribery. Make the concealed carry process in New York City a shall issue process. So that if you meet the statutory requirements, you get your concealed carry license. And again, all of a sudden, there's no opportunity for graft. There's no market for it. There's no reason for it. Do you think that that's how the city's going to respond to this? I don't think so. No, I would imagine, if anything, They'll probably try to make it more difficult for people to legally exercise their constitutional rights there in the Big Apple. In return, providing a bigger and greater incentive for those who can grease the skids and make that happen. But we will pay close attention to this story, again, just breaking out of New York City this afternoon. Why don't we take a quick time out, see if I can find more information on this. Bob Aldridge is going to join us from Indiana Farms Training after a break. Tim Lee next hour as well, plus Hero of the Day coming up top of the hour along with the Deal of the Day and Good Guy. We will be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking to our good friend John and Oni with 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. John, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
I am on top of the world.
How are you? How's Allentown?
Allentown is in need of some improvement, and I guess that's why I'm there.
Amen, brother. So first of all, you got some neat projects I want to talk to you about, but tell folks, what is 2 Million Bullets and what's Camp Compass? What do you do?
2 Million Bullets is actually an orange-ribbon campaign to prioritize our children in the youth shooting sports. That as well as Camp Compass, which is a nonprofit that rewards inner-city kids with outdoor excursions, basically hunting and shooting.
How long have you been doing this?
Ooh, I've been grinding a long time, 20 years. 20 years, 22 at the camp. I've been in the classroom for another 27. So we tend to say that there is nobody walking this earth that knows kids better than I.
Yeah, I would say that's true. So let's step back for a second before we talk about your new project. How did you get into all this?
You know, it wasn't by my choice, actually. You know, sometimes this road that I'm on is a pretty lonely road, because saving kids is not an easy thing, especially, you know, you might as well put devil horns on me, because not only do I save them through using the gun, but I save them through killing stuff. Wow. Basically our critters, you know, so it's
God's
something
little
where,
creatures, yeah, John. What kind of person are you?
You know, according to my kids, a pretty darn good one, you know, it's something where, you know, I found this because of a need. And wanted to make sure that other kids who had the same need, you know, have that fulfilled.
Awesome. So what did that lead to first? What's the timeline?
You know, Camp Compass, you know, I actually started out of the back of my truck in 94. Just thought the books weren't cutting it and needed to reflect on my life to see what made a difference in my life. And, of course, it was shooting. And it was hunting non-traditionally, of course. With that... went back into the classroom to teach, to try to help, and just figured out that it was something that I needed to give back.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. What you're doing now and been doing for 20 years couldn't be more important now, because there's a lot of talk about, not only about hunter numbers, and some people say they're going up, they're going down, but it's not just that, it's just attack on that lifestyle, on hunting, on the outdoor sports, on shooting, like from people on the other side who have really ramped up the rhetoric. Your devil horns, yeah. John, are growing bigger and bigger and bigger because they think you're so evil.
You're right. And you know what? You know what? If I could kind of counter that a little bit, you know what's starting to be a pretty neat role that's starting to happen is people on the other side are starting to come to me and say, you know what? I'm looking at this a little differently because you're saving our kids. And you know, it's something where it's hard to be the king of both mountains, but I can tell you that there are some people on the other mountain that are starting to climb up mine because they understand that our kids, their lives are critical, and they want to see ultimately kids win just like we do. And
absolutely.
I think we're starting to convince some people that what we do is a pretty good thing.
Awesome. All right, so let's talk about the new camp. What do you have going on? Something new.
You know what? Actually, we have a new documentary that is coming out called Camouflaging Our Differences. Pretty strong title. And I say that with excitement, because I think we get a knock in the industry in regards to who the industry is, you know, who the industry is portrayed to be. And I can tell you, I walk the halls and I meet with people constantly that are of color and of non-color, and I can tell you what, the bottom line for us is kids. So that's the reason we decided to name it Camouflaging Our Differences. It may shake some people up a little bit because they might be a little uncomfortable. However, change is change is coming.
Sometimes, John, people need to be shaken up a little bit.
Well, and I don't do it, you know, because I get a rise out of it. I do it
No, I mean, understood.
Yeah. I do it because, you know, it's necessary for me to save kids' lives. And, you know, I could walk 30 kids through this hall today, and they would receive the same love that I would get, probably even more, because once again, our people want to see these kids win, not necessarily in a pro-gun agenda, but in life.
Right. All right, John Anone, 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. How do we get more information about all the great things that you're doing?
You know what? You can look me up on those sites, 2 Million Bullets, 2millionbullets.com.org, or campcompass.com or .org, and you'll find me there.
John Anone, thank you so much for what you have done and what you continue to do, and thanks for visiting us here at NRA News.
Ah, pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. All right, coming up, we've got more news on this bribery investigation in New York City involving the head of the NYPD's licensing division, Michael Indall, who has been transferred. Sergeant David Villanueva, Police Officer Richard Oketal, with the licensing department, placed on modified assignment, and more details about the allegations of bribery regarding the issuing of gun licenses, pistol permits, in New York City, coming up in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Indiana Firearms Training, Bob Aldridge is with us. Bob, how are you, sir?
Great, Cam. Great to be back on the show.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you here, and I'm really glad to see you speaking up and speaking out about this. So you saw something in your local paper, right, the Journal Gazette.
Correct.
And they had this story, Three Simple Laws to Greatly Cut Gun Deaths. Now, we've seen this, Bob, since this article came out. I think it was in the Lancet Journal, right, saying, listen, if we just pass a couple of these minor gun safety regulations, we can see violent crime drop by 90%. As you point out, even anti-gun activists have been saying, listen, there's some real problems with this study. But this was presented very uncritically in your local paper?
Well, actually, in the local paper, it didn't even say who the lead researcher was or the title of the article. And so I had to track that down to find out what the heck it was. And I am right now looking at the website, the New England Journal of Medicine, mm-hmm. Journal Watch, and here it says, quote, in the Lancet, Dr. Bindu Kalesan and her colleagues examined state gun laws and associated with the lowest mortality rates, by the way, that was from the Brady campaign, and concluded that if three of these laws were implemented at the national levels, rates would drop, this is firearm mortality, by over 90%.
Over 90%.
And that's right off the website of the New England Journal of Medicine. And
yeah.
Got that published in the Lancet, of all places. And then the folks on her side of the fence excoriated her for this thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and rightfully so. I mean, so the three things that they wanted what, the quote-unquote universal background checks, right?
For firearms, and then universal background checks for ammunition.
And what was the third measure that they wanted?
Firearm identification, ballistic fingerprinting, and micro-stamping. And by the way, that third one would result in an 80% reduction in gun suicides.
Micro-stamping?
Uh-huh.
How?
You tell me and we'll both know.
Okay. Okay. So,
yeah.
Again, now you start to get a sense of why this article was greeted with a great deal of disbelief. First of all, it should be noted, I mean, when it comes to micro-stamping, California has a micro-stamping law on the books, the result of which is you haven't seen the introduction of new handguns in the California market because nobody's micro-stamping. So maybe that's how you'd see this
right.
reduction, right? People just couldn't
right.
buy firearms.
Right.
But, you know, as far as the quote-unquote universal background checks for firearms, universal background checks for ammunition, Bob, why do you contend that you could put those things in place and you would not see a dramatic decrease in violent crime?
They're, to a great degree, already in place. And somebody that would claim that on top of the approximately, who knows, nobody knows exactly how many, federal laws, state statutes, local ordinances there are regarding firearms, but 20,000 plus, and all of a sudden these three are going to result in a 90%+ reduction in gun deaths. It's ludicrous. I mean, it's bogus. So how else do you do that? And then you have Dr. Hemingway, David Hemingway, who is frequently on the Brady campaign's publications saying that couldn't happen. It's too big.
So you
and
can...
And it goes on with Dr. Dave... no, Garen...
Garen Wintemute.
Yeah, you know him, I suspect. I'm generally skeptical of cross-sectional studies of association. Well, the association that she did was cross-sectional, which, first of all, doesn't work. It wasn't time series. And then she used different years. So cherry-picked the years to get the associations she wanted to extrapolate to that to get this 90% reduction. And then Dr. Daniel Webster, John Hopkins, Center for Gun Policy and Research, definitely not pro-gun, briefly, this is not a credible study and has no cause and effective inferences that can be made from it. What I find both puzzling and troubling is this very flawed piece of research is published in one of the most prestigious scientific journals around, The Lancet. Something went awry here, and it harms public trust.
So
that's from a pro-gun guy.
Yeah, and so, you know, you gathered up all of this information. You wanted to present it to your local paper.
Right.
You wrote a piece, and what happened?
Well, I got no response when I first submitted it. And about 5 days later, I thought, well, who knows? Maybe, perhaps, it blocked the email that I did. So I did it on another email address and got a response that just said, I received it. I have not yet decided to publish it. That was it. That's all I got.
Wow.
And the next day, I got, so I'd be happy to publish it if you would reduce it to 200 words or less, which is by more than two-thirds. And we will put it in letters to the editor. In other words, in the back pages in a list of letters to the editor. And that very same day, on the front page, a 1,200-word anti-gun column appeared that was courtesy of the Washington Post. So I wrote it back and said, thank you for your generous offer. And I noticed that this new column is on the front page, and thank you. And that was it.
So you get the 200-page letter to the editor, and they'll go ahead and reprint another 1,200-word anti-gun screed.
They already did. I mean, they've already done a number of them. So suffice to say, I am not exactly persona grata there.
Well, no, but I got to say, Bob, I do appreciate you taking the time to present that information, even if... even if the editor, you know, wanted it, you know, whittled down to 200 words, it is better than nothing. And hopefully, you know, we'll be able to amplify this a little bit here on our program and help
right.
get the message out. Because this is, you know, we were just talking earlier in the show, there's a new study out showing 6% of Americans say they have a great deal of trust in the media these days. And this, I think, is a perfect crystallization of why that is
right.
the case. You know,
right.
here you have somebody. Now, look, maybe the editor isn't an expert. Maybe the editor saw this and thought, oh, this is an interesting story. But when presented with information, when presented with facts that contradict that opinion piece, again, from people who are both anti-gun, both pro-gun, but who have problems with the scholarship. Those concerns get dismissed because at the end of the day, I think ultimately you probably got someone there in the editorial offices who likes what that article has to say.
Sure.
Even if it's not true, they agree with it.
Sure, exactly. It fits the agenda.
Yeah.
So therefore, we'll publish it. And then that flawed study, as we say, which is basically bogus, becomes the definitive analysis of what will reduce gun deaths, firearm gun deaths in the United States. Which is just nonsensical.
Yeah.
But,
it is indeed. Bob, listen.
I don't fit their agenda.
No, you don't, but you fit ours. So there's a consolation prize. And again, I do appreciate you speaking up and speaking out. I've got to ask, how are things for you there at Indiana Firearms Training? You still seeing a great deal of interest?
Just had a weekend of AR rifle carbine classes. And... went extremely well, wiped us both out. The instructor is Sergeant Bradley Schultz, Fort Wayne PD. He was 10 years EST. He has been in two officer-involved shooting. He's just fabulous range trainer, so he was lead on that. I was not. So it's going really well. The weather finally turned nice, so we're doing great.
That is great to hear. Listen, thanks so much for coming to the program. Thanks for what you do, and I hope we can talk again.
Take care.
You too. Bye. Bob Alders joins us with the Indiana Firearms Training here on NRA News, Cam and Company. All right, so more out of the NYPD, this corruption probe. ABC7 says a Brooklyn businessman arrested on Sunday for allegedly bribing NYPD officials for handgun permits in the latest turn in the federal investigation of city corruption. 44-year-old Shea Alex Lichtenstein, charged with bribery and conspiracies, arraigned this afternoon in federal court. Deputy Inspector Michael Indall, who heads the NYPD's license division, which issues handgun permits, has been transferred. Sergeant David Villanueva, Police Officer Richard Oaktal, both placed on modified assignment. ABC 7 says Lichtenstein was a member of a volunteer security force in Borough Park, Brooklyn. He is alleged to be expediting handgun licenses, which are difficult to obtain, to friends and other businessmen. Officials say that he would allegedly charge his friends, members of the Orthodox community, between $5,000 and $25,000 to expedite their gun permit requests. Arrested by NYPD Internal Affairs and FBI agents on Sunday. You know, again, if you don't require a permit to own a firearm, then you don't have this opportunity for graft, do you? If you have a shall issue system where you meet the statutory requirements, you get your license within 30 days, 60 days, you don't have these opportunities for graft and corruption. But when you leave it up to one or two individuals who can decide for any reason or no reason at all to deny you your right to keep and bear arms, when that decision comes after you have paid hundreds of dollars in application fees in New York City, and you don't get that money back if you are denied for any reason or no reason whatsoever, then you create an atmosphere where corrupt officials can get rich off of the rights of residents. $5,000 to $25,000 to expedite the gun permits. Because, again, as I said, it can take up to a year simply to get permission to own a firearm in your home in New York City. It can take up to a year. All of that goes away. All of the potential for bribery and corruption goes away when there is transparency. Goes away when there is, again, a shall issue system in place, or when there is no permit required, no permission slip needed for you to exercise your fundamental individual constitutional right. But again, I don't think we will see Mayor Bill de Blasio take the city in that direction. No, again, if anything, I think what Bill de Blasio is likely to do is to try to make it even more difficult to exercise your legal right to keep and bear arms in New York City. And in return, probably, again, make it more attractive for corrupt individuals to try to subvert the process and make a buck or two or $25,000 for themselves. But we will continue to keep our eyes on any new developments in this. Again, the probe is widening. They now say up to as many as 150 permits may have been involved in this corruption probe. Now, again, there are no allegations at this point that anybody got a permit who wasn't legally eligible for one. That permits were given to people who were prohibited persons, for instance. No, the allegations are, again, that this was the people paid money to this sort of middleman. Hey, I can help you get your permit a little bit faster. Because otherwise, you know, it's going to get stuck there in the police department. You could be waiting months and months. SI Live in Staten Island, Staten Island Advance, with their coverage. They say Liechtenstein marks the first arrest in connection with this probe. But that's about the only additional information that they have here on the latest. We'll, again, continue following this story because I imagine we've not seen the end of this story. And I imagine we will also likely see some really, really shallow thinking from a lot of columnists there in New York about what the answer to this is. Again, look for de Blasio to make it harder for you to exercise, even harder than it already is now, for you to exercise your right to keep and bear arms. But here's the thing. You want to get rid of corruption? You want to get rid of corruption in this area? Then remove the opportunity for graft. Remove the opportunity for corruption. We're talking, again, about a fundamental individual constitutional right. There should be no opportunities for graft in the exercise of that right. All right. We've got the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, coming up top of hour three. Deal of the day, good guy as well. Our friend Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom will join us. By the way, over in the Northern Mariana Islands, where they have put a $1,000 tax, excise tax, in place on the purchase of every handgun, the governor there says, listen, this could be a role model for states on the mainland. Yeah, every state should think about a $1,000 tax on the purchase of a firearm. Stick around. We've got much more NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next. We've been talking about Virginia State Trooper Chad Durmeyer. Talked about the chief of Newport News, Virginia, where Chad Durmeyer served as a police officer. But, you know, and I thought about actually using our good guys segment today to talk about Trooper Chad Durmeyer. But I don't think we need to do that. I think we could just take a couple of minutes here. In fact, maybe we should take a couple of minutes here to talk about the good guy that was Chad Durmeyer. He, as I mentioned, served in Newport News till 2007, returned to Virginia, graduated from the Virginia State Police Academy in November of 2014. The Daily Press newspaper says that Brian Bowyer, who's a resident of Newport News, had a brief interaction with Chad Durmeyer, but it stuck with him. Bowyer's daughter was involved in an accident on the interstate in August of 2015. Bowyer is a former Newport News police officer, talked about the fact that Durmeyer was the investigating officer, and he talked about how Chad Durmeyer had a calming effect on those involved in the wreck. Bowyer said he had everything under control. It was obvious that his calling was to be a police officer. Said he was definitely a person that was happy, confident, and professional. Somebody that you'd be proud to have as a friend and as a coworker. Another news story from the Richmond area, Channel 13, WVEC. They had aired a story back in January of this year that featured Officer Chad Durmeyer. The story was talking about in Hampton Roads on a Friday morning, a guy driving to work, a guy named Dave Floyd, saw these two state troopers who were running down the road going after a little dog. Dave Floyd said they were like talking to the microphone back and forth trying to catch the little dog. The troopers involved in the pooch pursuit, Channel 13 says, Chad Durmeyer and Jeremy Hagwood. First spotted the dog on Interstate 64 in Hampton at LaSalle Avenue. Tailed the little dog by car and then on foot to I-664 at Aberdeen Road. Chad Durmeyer said at the time he was a little guy and he was off to the races. 4 miles They chased the little dog. Trooper Hagwood said he didn't want to stop for us. He kept going around in circles, going the wrong direction on the interstate, running between cars. Some drivers stopped to help. Troopers eventually cornered the dog, scooped him up alongside the road. They were able to ID the dog. Thanks to tags, they returned him to his owner, Jeffrey Corbin, who said, quote, I want to say thank you. Thank you very much, so much. Pinta is a member of the family. He's a great companion to us. Story went viral locally there. Got thousands of likes on Facebook at the time. Chad Dermeyer told the Channel 13, makes me feel good. This is the type of stuff that makes up our good guy stories every day. And it sounds like that's who Chad Dermeyer was. One of the many, many good guys out there. Killed in the line of duty by a guy who, according to his own family, kind of took pride in being a bad guy. Wanted to be infamous. Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom, Chuck Michel of Michel and Associates on the shenanigans out there in California, the proposed ballot measure by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. They are in the signature gathering process right now, trying to get enough names for these anti-gun measures to appear on the ballot in November. And apparently, some of these signature gatherers are willing to say anything at all about these proposals, even if they have nothing to do with the actual proposals themselves. We'll get to that later on in the hour. Right now, though, let's start with our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense, the story from the Star News Online in Wilmington, North Carolina, where Hannah Delacorte reports that Wilmington police say they will not file charges in an April 9th shootout that left one man dead and another wounded. According to the Wilmington Police Department, Andre Daquan Bryant, age 26, and 24-year-old Travis Dixon exchanged gunfire at the Houston Moore housing complex. Andre Daquan Bryant died in the shooting. Dixon underwent emergency surgery for a gunshot wound to the chest. According to a release issued today by the Wilmington Police Department, after a review of the facts and circumstances surrounding the shooting, the department, in conjunction with the new Hanover County District Attorney's Office, has determined that the shooting was justified by self-defense. The release stated, quote, as a result, no charges are expected to be filed against anyone involved. The facts show that Travis Dixon, the 24-year-old, acted in self-defense and after being shot himself, shot and killed Andre Daquan Bryant, who was the aggressor in the incident. And so again, Travis Dixon, who was shot by his attacker, Andre Daquan Bryant, and survived and shot and killed his attacker. He will not be facing charges for acting in self-defense there. He is our hero of the day. Our deal of the day from South Carolina and the state newspaper. With a story from the University of South Carolina, Rachel Myers Lowe with the story. It was Thursday evening. A female student there at the University of South Carolina called campus police after noticing a guy seemed to be following her as she walked several blocks off the horseshoe to her car. When they arrived, USC police found 40-year-old Edwin Arnold Davis walking out of some nearby bushes. He admitted to police that he had been following the student. Edwin Davis, charged with breach of peace, he has now been banned from the University of South Carolina campus. The state newspaper reports that Davis has a long criminal history, including crimes of armed robbery, unlawfully carrying a firearm, sexual assault, aggravated voyeurism, and trespassing. He again was arrested and charged with breach of peace. But he'll be out soon. let's be honest here. This is not a charge that is going to keep Mr. Davis behind bars for a long period of time. But it's totally okay. You have nothing to worry about because despite Mr. Davis's lengthy criminal history, he's been banned from campus now. So there's that. He is also today's deal of the day. And our good guy of the day from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's a story of a police officer as well as a citizen in the right place at the right time. And again, able and willing to do the right thing. It was over the weekend when this two passerby, one an off-duty police officer and one a guy who was on his way to work, both saw a car catch on fire. It was on the downtown connector just out of University Avenue. I say it was over the weekend. It was actually Thursday morning. Hector Cisneros saw the flames. He asked his mom to stop the car that the two were in. He didn't even wait till the car had stopped before he jumped out and ran towards the car that was on fire. The 21-year-old said, I heard her screaming for help. He knew that somebody was inside that vehicle. The flames were too heavy on the driver's side, so Hector Cisneros reached for the woman through the passenger side. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution says by then there was another person there to help. Lois Strong had just finished her 12-hour shift. She was on her way home. She also saw the car that was on fire. She stopped a patrol car. She got out. She ran to help. And together, the pair were able to pull the woman to safety. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says the two heroes had acted fast without even a minute to spare. 20 seconds after the woman was freed from the vehicle, the car was fully engulfed in flames. And Lois Strong heard two explosions. Now, the woman still needed help. She was losing consciousness. And the paper says that traffic was jammed in the area at that point. So Officer Strong knew that it was going to be tough for an ambulance to reach the woman. So she moved her patrol car to shield the woman. She began directing traffic away from the burning car, whose supervisor arrived at the scene. Lois Strong later learned that the woman's car was stranded and in the path of a tractor trailer that was attempting to change lanes. The tractor trailer hit the car, which started the fire. Once the woman was safe, Hector Cisneros and his mom left. Lois Strong went on her way home. Major Brandon Gurley says, there is no doubt in our minds, looking back on it, that they saved that lady's life. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says, after getting some rest, Lois Strong returned to work Thursday evening, ready for another 12-hour shift. A Brookhaven officer since July of last year, who said a day off wasn't necessary, even after saving someone's life, quote, you gotta keep going. And she did, and she has, and we thank Officer Lois Strong, as well as Hector Cisneros, again, not just for being in the right place at the right time, but for stepping up and doing the right thing as well. They are our good guys today. So I mentioned this NBC poll a little bit earlier in the program, showing a very tight race, margin of error, actually, between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over on the Democratic side. NBC News reports Clinton gets support from 50% of Democratic primary voters. Sanders gets support from 48%. That's down from Clinton's 9-point advantage a month ago. In the current poll, Clinton leads Sanders by 15 points among women, 57 to 42%, although that is down from her 20-point plus edge earlier this year. Now, it's important to note that the poll that NBC has conducted, this is a nationwide poll. This includes respondents from states that have already voted in the primary. So this is not a polling of voters in places like New York and Pennsylvania in California that have yet to hold their primaries. Over at Hot Air, John Sexton says Sanders is peaking too late. Had he gotten more aggressive sooner, he might not be looking at a double-digit loss in New York. But he says Politico reports that Sanders is not surrendering just yet. He told NBC's Today, those are the public polls. The bottom line is, let's look at the real poll tomorrow. Generally speaking, he says polling has underestimated how we do in elections. I would be very surprised if Bernie Sanders won New York. I'd be shocked. Single digits would be a pretty big surprise at this point for Bernie Sanders. But again, isn't it interesting that Hillary Clinton has been stumping hard for gun control? In fact, I would say that that is probably her primary avenue of attack on Bernie Sanders, and has been for at least the last week. And what has happened in this national poll? There has been a tightening of the race, which suggests to me that even among Democratic primary voters, those who you would think would be the most amenable to Hillary Clinton's argument, in fact, those who would be the most passionate about hearing Hillary Clinton stump for gun control, it hasn't translated into more support for Hillary Clinton around the nation. This is, you know, I do believe that the national media is far less interested in covering the Democratic primary than they are in covering the Republican primary. And they are far less interested in covering the cracks and divisions on the Democratic side than they are in covering the cracks and divisions on the right. But I'm starting to think that this is another story that the media really doesn't want to talk about. I have no doubt in my mind that there are political correspondents who have been following either the Clinton or the Sanders campaign who have noted that despite, or maybe because of, Hillary Clinton's repeated and vociferous support for any gun control law imaginable at this point. I mean, remember, she's come out in favor of Australia's compensated confiscation scheme. It hasn't helped her. In New Hampshire, when one in four of her campaign ads focused on gun control, it didn't help her. She didn't win. In Wisconsin, where she focused on gun control efforts, tried to tie gun control into the violent crime rate in Milwaukee, it didn't help her. She lost Wisconsin. There is, I think, very little evidence that gun control is a winning message for Hillary Clinton or any other national politician right now. You know, look, in reality, there is very little difference between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders when it comes to the Second Amendment and your right to keep and bear arms, right? I mean, there's this much difference. But if you listen to Hillary Clinton, there's a world of difference. If you listen to Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders is like the second coming of Charlton Heston. And, you know, he's probably having lunch with Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox, like, on a daily basis. And, I mean, like, that's how she portrays Bernie Sanders. And it hasn't made him more unpopular, even among the Democratic base. Now, again, the political media may not want to talk about this. I'm guessing there are probably actually a lot of folks within the Clinton campaign who don't really want to talk about this. They are fully vested in this. There's no flip-flopping on this. There's no going back to Hillary 2008. There's no going back to, I mean, sure, I suppose you could, but you already have a credibility gap. You already have a majority of voters that think you're dishonest. So at that point, sure, what do you have to lose by flip-flopping? But I think that this year they are committed to the anti-gun game. I remember Michael Bloomberg has been saying for months now to candidates at the national, at the state level, it's okay to talk about gun control. It's okay to come out in support of gun control. If you come out in support of gun control, well, you know, I'm going to be spending a lot of money this election year. And some of that might go to you. You never know. So I don't see her backing down. But I also don't see this having the effect or the impact that she thought it was going to have in the Democratic primary. Expand this to the general. I'll be honest with you. If I were part of the Clinton camp right now, I would be very concerned about my candidate declaring war on lawful gun owners while refusing to acknowledge the people who are actually committing violent crimes. Remember, Hillary Clinton cannot say criminals are committing violent crimes. She can't do it. I take that back. I assume that her mouth is capable of saying those words. But she won't do it. She won't. Criminals do not commit crimes. In Hillary Clinton's vocabulary, guns commit crimes. Guns come down from Vermont, and they commit crimes in New York. But there are no people involved, except for the victims of the guns. But there are no individuals who are actually committing those violent crimes. There are guns. There's the gun lobby. There's the gun manufacturers. There are the gun owners. There are the there's the NRA. But nowhere in that violent crime that's committed, is there an actual criminal committing that violent crime? Or if there is, Hillary Clinton doesn't want to acknowledge that individual. '50-'48, Clinton over Sanders in this new NBC poll. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. We've got the Liberty update for you right after a quick timeout. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company on the way.
All right, so we're out walking around here, and I ran into Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. All right, tell me, what is Klecker Knives? What are you all about?
Klecker Knives is basically about innovation, family values, good old whatever I can do to help people enjoy their time in the outdoors and bring their family doing it.
All right, and you got some really neat stuff, so show us some of your products here.
Well, the first one I want to show here is the trigger. This is basically like a knife kit. We designed a wooden one that we released before with my son Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
This is the follow-on version. The idea behind this is it's a bunch of parts you can build together like a model car or model plane.
Cool.
You put the pieces together, and it's a full locking knife, but it's not sharp. It's guaranteed to cut butter, though.
That's cool. What else you got?
So then the next one is, this is the Cordovan. This is our most popular folding knife. And the idea behind the Cordovan is that it has a locking system that I have a patent on. So this is called the Klecker Lock. Then over here we have a new one for this year. Is called the Abiqua. Comes built with a Kydex sheath. The idea behind the Abiqua is that people want really good, comfortable hunting knife. Fits good in the hand. But the benefit of the Abiqua is that it has a built-in gut hook right into the handle.
Oh, nice.
So it gives you a nice, full three-finger gut hook, so you're not going to lose it. So this is called the Klax. It stands for the Klecker Axe System. The idea behind this is, how can you go to the woods, have the tools you need, and not have to carry all the bulk that you would normally.
Okay.
So on a regular axe, you're going to carry around an axe that's got a handle about this size.
Right.
But with this, you carry around just this. When you need to, you can take this, use it as a hand tool, carve yourself a handle, you cut a split in it, and then you flip the clamps out, slide it down over the handle, tighten it up, whack it on the log a few times, seat the clamps, and then you can start going to town.
Awesome. How can folks get more information about Klecker Knives?
So you can find us on the web at kleckerknives.com.
All right. Glenn Klecker with Klecker Knives. Save the best for last. Dennis, one. This is one for you for Dennis's auto. There you go, buddy. Thanks for being on NRA News. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred. And I will call you out for who you are. An Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do. And I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit. And I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one, because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
So much for joining us here on NRA News. Cam and Company, Chuck, Michelle, and Michelle and Associates. Later on in the hour, we're going to talk about the signature gathering process in California, going after your right to keep and bear arms. And apparently, they are just willing to say whatever they think it'll take to get folks to sign their name to the bottom line. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom with us on the program right now. CFIF Online is the Twitter handle. How you doing, Mr. Lee?
Doing well. Hope you all had a good weekend.
It was, you know what? It actually was pretty darn good, I got to say. It was, weather was nice. I was outside. I discovered a new hard cider cellar in Virginia, which is always fun. So, yeah.
And no helpless animals were killed.
Not by my hand, anyway. Not this weekend. We've got probably another week or so before some of our bacon seeds go off to freezer camp. That's how we put it. Yeah.
Well, that gives me a week to get out there and bring my big truck.
Are you a part of the Porcine Liberation Army? Is that what you're going to do there? Just free the pigs?
If they stick to just pigs, then no, I'm part of the broader army. It's going to be just like Animal Farm.
All right, I'm not telling you anything about what's going on at my place. Anytime we're going to be making, you know, gyro meat with the goats, I'm just not going to say a word to you.
Goats are only for lawnmowers, not food.
They're multitaskers. They're multitaskers. You can get milk. You can get meat.
Until I eat my lawnmower, you shouldn't eat your goat.
You just need a taste of your lawnmower, buddy. That's the problem. Do you have any issues, by the way, with using dairy goats?
As in milking them?
Yes. Is that okay?
I wouldn't go so far as the vegan thing, and I'm not quite sure why getting honey constitutes abuse. I don't know anything about beekeeping, but my assumption was that when you take honey from bees, you're not killing any of them. I don't know what is really going on there. So, no, just freeing the helpless animals. That's all.
It's just, I think, you know, I'm not sure you're allowed to, partake of honey. It's exploitative, I believe, of the bees, right?
Well, so essentially a slavery type thing. There's really no limit to the nuttiness sometimes of the left, but and not all vegans are on the left, of course. But let's face it, there's a pretty big overlap. If that's the concept, that we're sort of coasting off the free or enslaved labor of bees, then that's out there.
It is indeed. All right. So what are you focusing on this week at the Center for Individual Freedom?
Well, a lot of people have probably seen our ads continuing on the Puerto Rico bailout. And so that's running and certainly garnering a lot of attention. It was interesting on Friday to watch a special report with Brent Baer. And, hey, there we are, the subject of the first panel there. Unfortunately, it sort of undermined a little bit of my faith in Charles Krauthammer. Love the guy and almost always agree with him, but I wasn't quite sure that he was picking up on what is really happening with Puerto Rico. But that's another reason. I don't mean to insult him or anything like that, but look, he's a pundit and he's probably asked to speak on things that really aren't within his sphere of preferred knowledge. And I don't mean that as an insult either. I just mean that he didn't quite grasp what's going on with some of the bondholders and how this Puerto Rico legislation is bad. But at any rate, we're still working on that. So a lot of people out there listening to this show will probably recognize some of the commercials. We opposed the Super Chapter 9 bailout. And then last week, I wrote on a piece called Bill Clinton versus Black Lives Matter. And a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with the confrontation that occurred a couple of weeks ago between Bill Clinton and some Black Lives Matter protesters at a Hillary Clinton rally. Mm-hmm. For those who aren't aware, what happened is Bill Clinton's speaking there, and the Black Lives Matter movement has targeted Hillary Clinton because during the 1990s, she referred to some of the criminals targeted by Clinton administration anti-crime efforts as super predators. She didn't limit what she said to black gang members or Hispanic gang members or anything like that. She
right.
just talked about people who were committing some of these horrific crimes that required action by the federal, state, and local governments. And so she referred to them as super predators, which they were. A lot of these gang members target little kids, not only for murder, but to use them, to run the drugs, to commit murders themselves, and do all sorts of things like that. So what are they, if not super predators? But at any rate, 20 years later, a lot of people object to that characterization by Hillary Clinton, so they showed up to protest a Bill Clinton speech. And to his credit, Bill Clinton was having none of it. He did his famous finger wagging and lectured them and said essentially that, you guys claim to represent Black Lives Matter, but the laws that I passed and that my wife Hillary favored saved those lives that you claim matter. The direct quote was, I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders that got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out to the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. You are defending the people who killed the lives you say matter. Tell the truth. You are defending the people who caused young people to go out and take guns. There was a 13-year-old girl in Washington, D.C. who was planning her own funeral. So to his credit, Bill sort of stood up. I think afterward he kind of backtracked a little bit. He didn't want to cause too much disruption to the campaign. But at any rate, it was an interesting conversation fight back by Bill Clinton. And I put it in a different, broader context as well. And that is this. You hear a lot these days about how the Republican Party has moved to the extreme right and that conservatives and Republicans today are somehow more extreme than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that the Republican Party holds many positions today that would seem foreign to Jack Kemp or Ronald Reagan or even Barry Goldwater 50 years ago. It's a pretty stable ideal of less government, stronger military, and at least compared to the Democratic Party, I think fidelity to conservative and timeless principles on which America was founded. In contrast, I think the Democrats have moved to the extreme. And at CFIF, we don't really touch the social issues. We don't get into abortion or gay marriage or anything like that. But just to illustrate, I mean, it was, what, 3-4 years ago that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both opposed same-sex marriage, but now they are in favor of it. And whatever your thoughts are on same-sex marriage, that shows which side is moving. There are a lot of positions, I think, today that Democrats take that would seem foreign to a Democrat like Morris Udall 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And Bill Clinton's a perfect example of that. He passed Get Tough on Crime laws that now are used to attack Hillary Clinton, his wife, while she's running for president. He signed a lot of economic reforms that actually – and this is something people don't realize, I think. Bill Clinton actually cut capital gains taxes. That's another example. And one really important example that we work on a lot at CFIF is Bill Clinton, I mean, he was president when the Internet became popularly accepted by the American public. And his FCC, to its credit, took a light-touch approach. It said, you know what, the best way to get the Internet to grow and this telecommunications sector to grow is to keep our hands generally off it. And that sentiment prevailed, obviously, through the Bush administration as well. So for two administrations, one Democrat and one Republican, you had the FCC sort of letting the Internet grow. And look where it got us. Unfortunately, now you have the Obama administration that is trying to regulate it like a 1930s-style telephone copper wire monopoly. And so they're really – it shows that the movement toward the extreme has – occurred on the left, not the right. And I think the Bill Clinton confrontation just sort of manifested that well. And so that was the point of my column.
You know, and it's interesting that I did see the piece that you were talking about. And, of course, Bill Clinton also talked about that great semi-auto ban that lasted mm-hmm. for 10 years. Here's the thing. I mean, you know, the ban expired in 2004. Violent crime continued to drop. Right. There were not a lot of crimes committed with those firearms before the ban, not a lot of guns used to commit crimes during the ban, and not a lot of those firearms used to commit crimes after the ban was over. But you know, look, Bill's wife is running on a staunch anti-gun position now, so she's talking about the need to bring that ban right back. I can see why he brought this up. Now, what's fascinating to me, we were just talking about this earlier in the show, Tim, Hillary Clinton cannot say that criminals commit crimes. She is so freaked out, as you say, over the super predator comment and over the protests that she has received. I don't think she can actually utter the words criminals are responsible for the crimes that they commit.
Because no, she can't.
She talks about guns, and this is not some sort of verbal tic. I've seen this in writing. I've seen this in her speeches. This is a line that she is now using. Guns coming from Vermont and committing crimes in New York.
Yeah, because we know all the guns produced in America occur in Vermont. That huge outflow of traffic from Vermont.
I mean, that part is absurd, but so is the part about guns committing crimes. You know, yeah. Again, she'll blame the gun lobby, gun manufacturers, NRA members. She's probably got a few crosswords for you. But for the actual perpetrator of that violent crime, she can't say a word.
Yeah, it's almost as though both the criminal and the victim are victims of the gun. And, you know, and you've talked about this on your show quite a bit, and it's something that bears emphasis because I think a lot of people out there don't realize it, but she's also getting on Bernie Sanders for this, for the federal law that protected him against just straightforward manufacturing liability. So when somebody goes out and shoots somebody with a perfectly functioning gun, it's somehow the gun's fault. And so they were declared immune from that in the same way that a knife manufacturer shouldn't be held accountable for murders that occur with knives, or baseball bat manufacturers shouldn't be held responsible for people who go out and beat people to death using a baseball bat. It's the same concept, but somehow it's mischaracterized by Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders. You don't often hear me defending Bernie Sanders, but when she's out there characterizing him as somehow taking the wrong position on that, when all it did was essentially codify into law that you're not going to hold the manufacturer of a firearm any more liable than you would any other device used for murder, as long as it functions perfectly, it wasn't inherently dangerous or anything of that sort. It's the criminal's fault. But you're right. It's another example of how extreme the political left has moved in the sense that they're unwilling to even hold accountable the actual criminals. And what the other thing I note is we've seen a 50% decline in murder over the last 20 to 25 years in America. Mm-hmm. We can all argue about the precise causes for that. Obviously, I think that having a lot more firearms out there and having concealed carry has played a role in cutting crime, but so have tougher laws on crime and criminals, including mandatory minimums and some of the tough incarceration policies. Those saved a lot of black lives. So as Bill Clinton said, if black lives matter, people who favored that. And by the way, Bernie Sanders voted for that bill as well. Not just the Clinton administration promoting it. Bernie Sanders, as a representative of Vermont, before he was a senator, voted for the Get Tough on Crime bills of the 1990s. So it just shows how far they've moved to the left that they can't even condemn criminals anymore. It's somehow racist.
Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. You can find him online, cfif.org. Tim, we've got to run, but enjoy your week. Eat some burgers for us, In-N-Out style, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot. You guys have a good week as well.
All right. When we come back here on NRA News Cam, accompany Chuck Michelle from Michelle and Associates with the latest on Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's anti-gun referendum efforts out in California. Running into some trouble. We'll see how many media outlets pick up on this. At least one in the Inland Empire has picked up on this. So far, though, the story seems to be a story of local interest, even though it has statewide implications. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company right after this.
It's not difficult for readers or viewers to make that leap from a distrust of men to an inherent distrust of guns. And that's exactly what, you know, Everytown, Shannon Watts, and newfound besties at Cosmo want you to understand and take away from that.
Yeah, this is, what really concerns me is because this isn't an honest debate and it's not an honest conversation.
No.
This is a branding campaign.
And, oh, my gosh, absolutely.
And, you know, what they are trying to brand is guns are not for women.
No, and I think that they're so used to pandering to a specific type of brand. You know, God forbid some of us women who want to take quizzes and see what scandal character we are and that we do morning yoga and we go to brunch with our girlfriends afterwards. God forbid we own firearms somehow. And we're now supposedly less than because we've educated ourselves and want to choose to take our self-protection seriously. Why is that so bad?
Well, I don't think it's bad at all. And, you know, it's interesting, Kimberly, because I think it may have been the same day that this video was released by Cosmo. There was the story, I know that you saw this out of Indianapolis, a young mom at home with her infant. Guy breaks in. Mm-hmm. She has a gun. She uses that gun in defense of herself and her child. The guy is found to have on his person zip ties and a walkie-talkie, which kind of tells me this guy was in communication with somebody else and this guy wasn't necessarily interested in the stuff.
Right.
That was inside that home. He was interested in the people who were inside that home.
So often, more often than not anyway, sex assault is about power and control. It's not about sex as so many people want you to believe, especially when it's being touted by a political campaign. You know, I have honestly been told, well, you survived without a gun. What's the big deal? You know,
wow.
You use different methods to get away, and they don't use a gun. And statistically, that could have been turned around on you anyway. The biggest problem here is that those comments start with victim blaming. It's on me somehow to think of ways to get away without turning to, like, literally the greatest equalizer of our time. Statistically, men are bigger than women. What's the best way to physically equalize myself against an attacker? A firearm. I'm not going to take my chances with a rape whistle or, you know, I actually tried saying that, hey, I made up a lie, said I have an STD, I have to go to the bathroom, I'm claustrophobic. I tried all of these things. They did not thwart that attack. But, I mean, furthermore, what no one cares to hear is that while I might have been my attacker's first victim that we could at least identify, at the time of his arrest, it was just 3 weeks later, he was picked up at an apartment complex not half a mile from mine. He was taking pictures of other college women that were sunbathing around the pool. He's choosing his next victim. So, yes, I survived. But at what point does this man's growing number of victims and escalating behavior stop? This guy had zip ties in his back pocket and all of these things. But, you know, we're not going to hear more than one or two media cycles because it doesn't fit the mainstream media narrative.
Right.
But he had to start somewhere. And I'm guessing he started at the same point as my rapist did. It's breaking in. It's stealing underwear. It's seeing how far you can get. How far can you push until you just start escalating and escalating? And, yes, this woman did a fantastic job of protecting herself and her kids, and that story is not going to get the attention that it so deserves. But the Cosmo articles definitely will.
That's the thing. I don't even know if this story out of Indianapolis, I don't think it got national attention. I think I saw it in one other like local TV station that wasn't in the Indianapolis area. I had picked up the story, but you're right. And you know, the Cosmo story is going to get that attention. Here's the thing though. You know, I think, as you say, I don't think Cosmo is serving its audience, because I'm guessing, Kimberly, that there are some Cosmo readers out there who are also gun owners.
Or at least there were.
Or yeah. Okay.
Well,
point,
you know,
point taken.
So this is going to sound terrible. I was scrolling through their Twitter feed looking for that original post about the gun control conversation.
Yeah.
Let me give you a little brief taste of what these guys also peddle to their readers. Are you ready for this? What it's like to fall in love with your brother. Real headline. Are you sexually attracted to the wax version of Justin Bieber? And why drink normal beer when you can drink vagina beer? Excuse me, that is in no way, shape, or form the people that I want telling me about how best to protect myself. I literally feel my face melting from the stupidity.
Suffering from a lack of credibility is what you're saying.
I think that's exactly what this
is. Yeah. Out in California, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom really, really wants to take over the top job from Jerry Brown. And he is using gun control as a springboard to greater visibility. But he's run into some opposition. You know, there is the Coalition for More Civil Liberties that has formed. And they are noting some problems here with Gavin Newsom's anti-gun proposals and the people who are pushing them. Chuck Michelle of Michelle & Associates joins us on the program right now. How you doing, Chuck?
Good. Cam, as usual.
I'm glad that you're
you
with
doing?
Us. I'm good. I'm a little fired up about this. We've got some video here. I just want to show folks what we're talking about. So the anti-gun referendum is right now in the signature gathering process, correct?
Yes, and the signature gatherers are highly motivated because there are so many initiatives on the ballot that the price that they get paid for every signature they collect is rapidly approaching $5 per signature. And could go even higher. So every signature they get, that's $5 in their pocket.
Okay, so they have a, as you say, they're motivated. They've got a financial incentive to make sure that that you sign as many of these things as possible. Now, take a look and a listen to one of these signature gatherers out there in California describing one of the proposals by Gavin Newsom.
This one, if someone wants to buy a large quantity of ammunition, like 1,000 bullets, 500 magazine clips, single magazine clips, you're going to have to go through your background check. Just for large quantity, regular amounts is fine.
Okay, so now restate that.
What? If someone wants to buy a large quantity of ammunition, like 1,000 bullets,
uh-huh,
you're going to have to go through a background check. Most individuals, to pass the background check, if you want to buy a large quantity. Regular amounts is fine.
What's a regular amount?
I don't know exactly.
What's large? What's
I know because they're making, you know, people make bombs with like large quantities out of the ammunition. So for large quantities, you'd have to go through a background check. Also, you know, like 500 magazine clips, you know, you have to go through a background check for large quantity of magazine clips.
Is it who's putting this out?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I just know they're obviously initiatives they gave us to get onto the ballot.
Okay. No, I'm not going to sign that.
So there's just a little taste. Chuck, was anything that guy said accurate?
No, this is not about large amounts of ammunition. It's about any ammunition. You're going to have to go through a background check. And the process of creating that kind of a database, because remember, you're not allowed to use the NICS system to do background checks on ammunition purchases. And California is a point of contact state, so it's going to wind up having to build its own database, and that's why New York tried and failed and abandoned their effort to try and do background checks on ammunition purchases. It's just they estimated it was going to cost about $100 million just to build the database to do that. But it's not about it would apply to, if it passed, Newsom's initiative would apply to every ammunition purchase and every seller. They would both have to have licenses, effectively. And I don't know what he's talking about, 500 magazine clips. I mean, it's basically, it just shows the level of ignorance that these signature gatherers have, and the way they'll just distort the truth, distort what this initiative does. It would ban the possession of any magazine that held over 10 rounds. The possession, not just the purchase. You couldn't have one. And so just like they tried in Sunnyvale and Los Angeles, they've banned the possession there, and those ordinances are being challenged. They want to do that statewide now. It's probably important to note that no one has complied with that in either of the cities where they passed it. But the clip that you just ran was not even the worst. I mean, we had one woman saying that this would ban assault weapons, which obviously have been regulated in this state since 1989. And so they're really just trying to latch on to whatever buzzwords they can, mm-hmm. these signature gatherers, in order to get somebody to sign that initiative so they can put that $5 in their wallet.
Okay, so there is a law in California, because there's a law for everything in California, that says a signature gatherer who, quote, willfully and knowingly circulates, publishes, or exhibits any false statement or misrepresentation concerning the contents, purport, or effect of any state or local initiative, referendum, or recall petition for the purposes of obtaining any signature is guilty of a misdemeanor. In your legal opinion, Chuck, did we reach that threshold?
Well, there's a knowledge element. It has to be intentional. Now, remember, it's not just the signature gatherers who, if you give them, bend over backwards to give them the benefit of every doubt and just assume that they're ignorant rather than conspiratorial.
Mm-hmm.
Or lazy because they don't want to read the initiative. The signature gatherer's employer is also liable, potentially civilly and criminally, and the Gavin Newsom campaign itself can be liable for this type of deceit on the part of signature gatherers working for the signature gathering companies that the Newsom campaign employs. So we've sent a cease and desist letter to the Newsom campaign, putting them on notice that their signature gatherers are out there misrepresenting what this initiative would actually do, and telling them that they need to put a stop to it. We'll see if they pay any attention to that.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm guessing they won't.
Well, you know, their tactics suggest that you're right. Because the most recent tactic that they've demonstrated was we had a great campaign on Twitter telling people about the problems with Newsom's initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, Twitter shut us down, blocked our ad, canceled our campaign. And as we looked into that and started protesting, we discovered that Twitter executives had given $100,000 or so to Newsom and his campaign for governor. So it wasn't that particularly surprising that maybe somebody called over to one of their friends and said, shut this campaign down. Thankfully, the response was so the folks who realized that we were being censored that way, that the Coalition for Civil Liberties were being censored that way, they were so outraged that within 24 hours, Twitter had to reactivate the ad campaign again. But you talk about the strategy and tactics that the Newsom campaign is employing, and yeah, I think they're all sort of consistently dishonest.
Talking again with Chuck Michelle from Michelle & Associates out in California. When do these signatures have to be turned in, Chuck?
Beginning of June, and they need they're probably going to need about 500,000, at least 400,000, maybe 500,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot. And we'll be looking for opportunities to challenge the validity of these signatures. Because a court, if the signatures were obtained by pretense,
mm-hmm.
A court could actually keep this off the ballot. And so we have folks out there now, our grassroots out here, and I want to ask everybody who's listening to do the same. They're keeping an eye out for signature gatherers that are making these kinds of misrepresentations and sending an email to report@michellelawyers.com letting us know that this kind of thing is going on, and we'll look into it, and we're reporting it to the election authorities and making sure we can put a stop to this.
Talking again with Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates about the proposed anti-gun referendum, the problems that we're seeing here in the signature gathering process. And you know, again, Chuck, for folks who are only perhaps vaguely familiar with these proposals, what exactly is it that that Gavin Newsom wants to put on the books? I mean, these are things that have come up in the legislature before. They've actually been rejected by California lawmakers, haven't they?
Right. You know, basically Newsom is just using San Bernardino and the terrorists attack there and terrorism in other places to mislead people about laws making them safer. You know, we don't have a whole lot of overwhelming number of friends in the California legislature. So it sort of speaks volumes when the things that Newsom is proposing, a ban on the possession of magazines that hold over 10 rounds, licensing and background checks for selling or buying ammunition. No mail order ammunition. No, you'd have to have a storefront. 48-hour reporting of the loss or theft of a firearm. These are the kind of things that the legislature has considered and rejected. Remember, that's a fairly hostile legislature. So they had to have a pretty good reason to be rejecting those things. The California legislature actually went beyond Newsom, as hostile as they are, in respecting people's property rights. They banned the ability to buy those magazines anymore, but they grandfathered in the possessions of the ones that people already had. They've considered the ammunition background check bills before and recognized how expensive that would be. And how ineffective, because there have been ammo regulations. The ATF regulated for years, never really helped solve any crimes. So they rejected it. So for Newsom to now just resurrect this, and the reason he's doing it is to piggyback off of this and build some name recognition for his campaign for governor in 2018. And I think it's also very telling that the folks that drafted this actual proposal are the lawyers that work for the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, the Legal Community Against Violence, the folks that have basically become the de facto law firm for the gun ban lobby throughout the country.
This is, and as you say, this is not the only effort that they're working on. I mean, they are helping to craft anti-gun legislation and proposals all around the country, but this is what they've come up with in California.
Right. This is the initiative that they've come up with in California. They're also in the legislature right now pushing bills that would ban pretty much all semi-automatics. Think about that. All semi-automatics would become, quote-unquote, assault weapons and make it basically impossible for a gun store to operate because they're going to impose so many restrictions and conditions on the operation of a gun store. You have to photograph every purchaser of a firearm, keep that information for many years and be able to find it at a moment's notice. I mean, you're talking about, again, creating a big video library database. This is the kind of thing that the LAPD just abandoned their effort to put body cameras on every officer because the video library that you create has to be managed, and that's a big database management project.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to do this. So LCAV, formerly LCAV, and Newsom are very active, not just in the initiative, but also in Sacramento, pushing all kinds of bad, counterproductive, ill-conceived gun laws that will basically give the terrorists the upper hand and take away the chance that somebody might have to survive that kind of an attack or an attack of a criminal because they're being deprived of the most effective tools to use to defend themselves or their families, which is a firearm.
Chuck, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and I look forward to talking to you again. Folks can follow you on Twitter at Michelle Lawyers, michellelawyers.com, and join us again soon, will you?
StopTheAmmoGrab.com, Cam. That's where the information about the Newsom Initiative sits. We have to put everything through the pack, that's where folks can go to learn more.
All right. Thank you, sir. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Chuck Michelle with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, we told you, and you're probably going to see this too, migrating over from the Northern Mariana Islands, proposals in California on $1,000 per gun excise tax. The governor of the Northern Mariana Islands, Ralph Torres, says this could be a role model for other U.S. states. He says, quote, the Commonwealth has enjoyed a peaceful society through the unique treaty under the covenant with the United States for some 40 years. It's the law's intent that the possession and use of handguns will be for self-defense and not for the indiscriminate use to harm human life or to intimidate. The administration added, we have seen many cases of illegal gun possession and use which have needlessly harmed human life. In such instances, government officials and families of victims often call for stricter gun rules to prevent further loss of life. Even when guns have been banned, they call for stricter gun rules. I'm looking at a story from March of last year from the Saipan Tribune. Crimes in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, quote, staggering. Staggering. Over 15,000 crimes, traffic incidents, and criminal complaints in the last year alone. Now, this is a community of about 52,000 people there in the Northern Mariana Islands. Last year, Customs, Department of Public Safety, U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration Task Force seized $750,000 worth of meth on the streets of the Northern Mariana Islands. Oh, yeah, by the way, there are less than 100 police officers on Saipan to handle the more than 15,000 crimes and collisions and criminal complaints that have been filed. Since the police commissioner said he declared a war on ICE in January 2014, you've had two double murders. You've had several drug-related arrests, a missing person who has yet to be found. So it's not like the Northern Mariana Islands is this wonderful crime-free paradise that is going to be sullied and spoiled by the presence of legally owned firearms. No, the drug problem and the crime problem that comes with it is already there on the islands. What isn't there, at least right now, is a government that respects the right of law-abiding citizens to keep and bear arms for self-defense. We'll see you here soon with more Cam and Company.